We celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Picasso in Daly Plaza. We talk politics with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy, and live music from Chicago Rockers Dream Version.
Now here's your host, a man who can't wait to watch the Bears home opener, Justin Kaufman.
Hey, I know that voice. Oh, that was my son. That's nice. How'd you guys do that? That's great. Wow. Kind of ruined the joke there, but that's good. How fun. That was fun. Yeah, today was a little bit of take your son to work day, so he's hanging around the office this morning or during the day, so it's nice to see you got him on air. He is union, so we need to see a paycheck on that. But then, well, that's nice. That's great. That could put a smile on my face. Thanks for that. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. What I was interested, I mean, what we were talking about was I can now safely say that I am back on to watch this home opener of the Chicago Bears playing the Atlanta Falcons because Jay Cutler is no longer going to be in the broadcast booth. If you've been a listener to the show, you heard me ranting about this for the last 2 weeks, and they must have heard me. The NFL probably had some closed-door meetings and said, let's make sure we get Jay Cutler back on the field because otherwise we're going to lose Justin Kaufman all season long. That's amazing. So he is going to play for the Miami Dolphins, which is fine by me. Don't care. But it's just great that we can go back to some nameless former defensive back breaking down why Mike Glennon threw that interception. I'm okay with that. Much better than if Jay Cutler was doing that, right? It feels good. I feel good. Now I feel energized and optimistic about the Bears this season. Coming up tonight, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy will be in studio. We will do touche as the president takes a vacation, working vacation, which just means Twitter. It's ridiculous. I'm going to be on a working vacation. All right. Do what I did. When I went to San Diego, I shut my phone off. Just do that. That would be fine for 14 days. Well, we'll talk about Trump at 200 days coming up here, and Dave and Chris will have thoughts on that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the 50th anniversary of the Picasso Daly Plaza. I have someone from SOM in studio, someone from the Department of Cultural Affairs. We'll talk about what that piece of public art, the sculpture, did for Chicago back in 1967 and what it does for Chicago now. We'll talk about public art and, of course, that controversy all coming up in the 8 o'clock hour tonight. A good conversation about the 50th anniversary of the Picasso. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Industry Night, our weekly segment where we look at food and hospitality. I'm excited to say that we'll be talking hotels tonight. The Chicago Athletic Association Hotel is one of the newest in Chicago. They're renovated right down on Michigan Avenue. It was very busy this weekend with Lollapalooza. I would assume. We're going to talk with the general manager of the hotel about what goes into hospitality and hotel services in this day and age. If you're a hotel that's going after a younger clientele, what needs to be there? Does the idea of hotel management change as you change demographics? We'll talk about that in Industry Night tonight, the 9 o'clock hour. And then the band Dream Version will be in studio tonight. Very excited to have them as they talk about their latest album, which is a protest album. They'll be also playing live in Studio 435. So excited tonight. We have a jam-packed show as usual. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Let's do the carryout. Here today's top stories, President Trump is on vacation and the media just can't stand it. So they're poking the hibernating bear with stories of presidential primaries in 2020, which meant that Trump had to put the pina colada down and head to Twitter to let us all know that he's super popular and fake news is faking fake. Hey, the president's on vacation. That means can we need a vacation too? Take a week off from the leaks and write about county fair accidents. We'll click through. Nothing scares us more than a roller coaster accident slideshow. Boom. Million hits, and then you can get back to Trump in a week or so. We cool, media? We cool? Please. CPS lays off over 950 people today to get the budget in line. I can't decipher if this is just normal trickery where teachers get pink slips but are hired back in a couple weeks, or if this is the real deal situation where administrators, teaching assistants, security guards, and teachers were shown the door. Maybe I'm naive, but as a parent of a CPS student, I will say I don't usually think that any of the aforementioned jobs are elective. Right? Class sizes are over 30 to 35 kids. They're usually one or maybe two security guards, and none of the teachers actually have teaching assistants. And my son goes to what a quote-unquote good school is. So are these real layoffs or political layoffs? And frankly, who cares? Neither are acceptable. The fact that the state of Illinois, Chicago Public Schools, and the financial wizards at the top of the city of Chicago mismanage pension funds shouldn't mean that good Chicago people should lose a job. That's ridiculous, right? That's the exact opposite of what the punishment should be for financial mismanagement, right? It shouldn't be that politicians didn't pay pensions so you get fired. That's not good government. That's not good for anything. There's no corruption there. The fact that somebody is going to get a pink slip because we didn't pay a pension payment 8 years ago, that's not on that teacher or that security guard. That's ridiculous. That's not the answer. City of Chicago just sued the Justice Department over the threat to withhold criminal justice monies if the city doesn't adhere to Trump administration immigration policing policies. The police say that they will not hold anyone longer than 48 hours, regardless of immigration status. And this is at the core of the new Trump policy to give ICE agents more time to capture and deport. But Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson has the best point on this. This is what he said today. The minute his officers hold someone over 48 hours, the allowed time that you can hold someone before processing, they will be turning around those people and suing the city police department and specific officers. And you know this. That's exactly what we need, right? That's exactly what the city needs. More civil lawsuits. Because you know it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if that person's in for the worst crime ever. They will sue and they will win because that breaks the law. Put your politics, put your immigration politics aside. It's probably a smart move for the local politics or local politicians to challenge that. West Nile was discovered in mosquitoes tested in Glencoe. Great, the mosquitoes have evolved. They're going after the rich. Uh-oh. Probably tastier blood from all that caviar, right? Anyway, time to invest in bug spray. Cops arrested a thief who had allegedly stolen 60 cell phones at Lollapalooza this weekend. 60! Man, oh man, there were a lot of confused teenagers trying to find their parents. Oh, she's not texting back. What's wrong? We said to meet by that white tent. There's so many white tents down here. A new class action lawsuit's been filed against Dunkin' Donuts for imitation blueberries. Yep, the muffins, donuts, and other pastries are marketed as blueberry, but the suit alleges that it isn't blueberry. It's just some artificially blue-colored mystery food. I don't know about you, but when I go into a Dunkin' Donuts, I think organic, locally produced produce. Right? Don't you? Just me? In weather, nice enough day. In sports, it's official. The Miami Dolphins signed former Bears quarterback Jay Cutler to a one-year deal worth about $10 million. This after the Dolphins quarterback went down with a knee injury, so Cutler will not be in the broadcast booth this year telling us what, quote, Mike Glennon saw on that play. And this means by default, like I said, I'll watch Bears games this year. If Cutler was in the booth, I'd be picking apples come Sunday. But he's not, so we're good to go. 13-3. You heard it right here. 13-3. Let's go. Family Fest came and went. No injuries to speak of. But today, not so lucky. Backup offensive lineman Eric Kush tore a hamstring, out for the year. Still, the Bears are in a better spot health-wise than they were around last year this time. The Cubs fought hard but watched their bullpen implode again in the loss yesterday to the Nationals. The Cubs lost 2 of 3 from the NL East leaders, and this will be two straight series at home against potential playoff teams where the Cubs lost. Hey, but with the hard-fought losses at Wrigley, the Cubs somehow still hold the lead in the NL Central. I don't know what that means. Yep, they got a half-game lead up on the Brewers. We're 2 months to go until the season is over, so time's starting to get tight. The Cubs go tonight against the Giants in San Francisco, who are downright awful this year thanks to an off-the-field injury to Madison Bumgarner, who's riding his dirt bike. They also have Buster Posey. But after that, I'm having a hard time. Who plays on the Giants? Right? I mean, I guess Samardzija is there. Hunter Pence is probably still there. Who else? Does Vita Blue? Is Vita Blue still pitching for this squad? How about Robbie Thompson? Robbie Thompson holding down second? How about an Atlee Hammaker? Yeah. Or maybe the best name in 80s baseball history, Candy Maldonado. And there's your San Francisco Giants from the 80s. Speaking of 80s baseball players, Don Baylor passed away today. The former Cubs manager was fighting cancer. He was 68 years old. It's a bummer. The White Sox got swept right out of Boston this weekend. They've won three games since the All-Star break. Is that right? That's woeful. Hoping this is a yin-yang type thing, cause and effect maybe, meaning the 2017 White Sox are really, 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 really bad so that the 2020 White Sox will be really, 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 really good? It works that way? Please tell us. Also, keep Nicky Delmonico. He's a guy who should have been playing in the 80s, but somehow he's on the 2017 team. Nicky Delmonico. I don't know what he's done so far, but I just saw him standing at second base. I'm like, what a name. Yeah, I'll bite. Yeah, I'll buy a Delmonico, a Nicky Delmonico jersey. Chicago Sky beat the Atlanta Dream this weekend. Quietly, they're putting a run together. They're currently 10-16, just outside the playoffs. The season winding down, but they're streaking, so I wouldn't be surprised if they sneak in. Also, the Chicago Fire are still in second place in the conference, but also second best overall as they start up the second half. Go Fire. And finally tonight, a new study out says that loneliness may be a bigger public health hazard than obesity. Yep, technology / smartphones lead to isolation, which leads to loneliness. Loneliness leads to depression and other life-threatening illnesses. The new iPhone, it's going to have facial recognition. Oh, so doesn't that balance it all out? Maybe not. That's the Gary Out for August 7, 2017. Hey, we're thinking about cutting back on straws due to the environment, so we're rationing them out. 20 per customer, cool? Cool. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling are here. It's Monday night, so it's time for Touche. Talk national politics, although these guys are chomping at the bit to talk local, which I think is a sign of the time that it's vacation. It's Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
So I bet while you were enjoying Chicago's finest artists, like Chance the Rapper, you were thinking of me putting up my pergola on the on the patio, and I was thinking of you enjoying Chance the Rapper.
I have a feel, we'll talk about it later, but maybe I could have come and helped you. I would have had a better time. Ooh, I love Chance. I love Chance.
Wow.
But dad mode kind of took over, you know?
Uh-oh.
I brought my son, and it was great. We had a great time. It all worked out great. But I've also, like, by the time Chance went on, I'm like, where's the exit?
Yeah.
Like, I started doing dad thing, like, okay, there's one over there. There's too many people in this park. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go.
That's yeah. So, how was that the way, monster trucks, I was doing that too. Yeah. Where are we going now? We're done?
Yeah. How was the pergola?
Done. It's up.
Yes.
I now have a patio that I truly enjoy
sitting
out on. It's good.
All right.
Ready to go?
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go right, you go right, you go
left, you go right, you go right. It's Touche here on the Download.
Touche.
720 WGN, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio as they are every Monday night. Great to see you guys.
Happy Monday.
You guys.
Monday.
I feel like we always start the week off strong.
Beautiful WGN.
With the two of you arguing over politics. There's nothing better in my
politics
mind.
Politics argument of Chicagoland.
And then that starts your week off strong, and then what happens?
It just all goes downhill from there, right?
No.
All right,
nothing goes up from
Let's
here.
Talk about the, I mean, we're coming up on Trump's 200 days here.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a marker that you would say.
Virginia Tech.
But let's talk about that. 200 days. Where do you rate this presidency?
Yeah, David.
Well, you know, Chris, it's going to come as a huge surprise to you that I would argue that these are the worst 200 days in modern American political history.
Worst.
It's just a train
you're
wreck.
Some popular support out there from the
train
people
wreck.
Train
yes.
wreck.
Train wreck. Because you look at it. Okay, all the conservatives will say is Gorsuch. Gorsuch. It's like become a reflex. It's like, well, Trump sucks. He can't get anything done. But Gorsuch. We got Gorsuch.
Oh,
I'm like, yeah, you got Gorsuch with the nuclear option. Congratulations. But in the meantime, healthcare dead.
Healthcare dead. It's alive.
Tax Kick reform. Good luck getting a consensus on that one.
Yeah.
And by the way, there was a new report out just this past weekend that said that of the top 40 positions in the State Department, 38 are still vacant.
Now I hear that story,
but David,
and I say
that's...
But they
are going to ask you tomorrow morning to join.
Yeah.
Hey, I've already been asked to be the new communications director of the White House because everybody else said no.
Well, Chris, so. I've heard that both ways on both sides where Republicans say that the Democrats are standing in the way of appointments.
There's some of that going on. But, you know, hey, 200 days in, we're getting exactly what I think we all expected. Trump is bombastic and annoying and says goofy things in his tweets and hurts himself frequently. The folks beneath him, not at the White House, but over in the administration, they're doing a lot of work. They're getting a lot of regulations repealed and things like that. That's terrific. I agree with David. I mean, the whole situation with Congress is, I totally blame this, not so much on Trump, but really on Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. We've talked about that. We can talk about it a little more. But I think that, you know, we've got a shot. We got Trump 2.0 with General
Aren't
Kelly.
Are we on 5.0 at this point?
No, we're on Trump 2.0, David. Pay attention. And, you know,
but
I think
the mooch
things,
was 2.0.
I think that this could get, I think things could get better.
Let me ask you about the economy. That's a big point. You've said it all along. The economy seems to be doing well. Wall Street's up.
But
jobs are up.
Yeah, but first of all, it's not up enough. Job creation is not up enough. What basically we're seeing is, not to say a straight line, but I mean, basically a trend line continuation of the growth under Obama. And I played this straight all along. The unemployment figure was wrong for Obama. It's wrong for Trump. The employment figure was not good enough for Obama. It's not good enough for Trump. And
because it's almost the same.
It neither was good enough for the American people and for this country. And that's what Trump has got to focus on. Although I don't think that healthcare is entirely dead. I think there will be an attempt to do something. But the key thing here is the economy.
All right. So let's talk about the other areas that he promised to make changes and he's moved one way or the other. Let's talk about immigration being one, illegal immigration crackdowns. He's also last week said they put a bill together with GOP senators to actually curb legal immigration. So
yeah,
immigration
has become. Let's talk about that bill. I last week was the Trump administration and the right-wing Bannon cadre, Bannon and Stephen Miller and all the right-wing fascist wannabes. The idea that they are
to say, I never.
You're
called,
right. They're not a fascist
never,
wannabe.
Wait a minute.
They're
wait,
just
wait, wait,
fascists.
Hold on a second, David. Did I ever say that?
Allegedly.
You know, Valerie Jarrett and her folks were commie wannabes. No.
You've got to be kidding.
It was
you got,
so,
hey, Chris.
I never did.
You can't lie
did.
On the air.
I'm
well,
not
okay,
lying.
You can, but.
I never said that.
Don't.
All right.
Come on.
And to say, to start
name calling
just shows
aside,
how weak you are.
Back to immigration. Back to immigration.
Fine. How about the proposal to cut green cards in half? To put the kind of restrictive tests that none of our ancestors could have satisfied to get into this country. If these tests were in place when Chris and I don't know when your parents came, grandparents, great grandparents.
Well, I'll tell you.
Came to this country. Mine came here in the early part of the 20th century.
Okay.
No way
no
they
way.
Could have gotten in.
Chris.
No way. Look, it's not the early part of the 20th century. It's not the 18th century when Enoch Fitzhenry ran off of a British man of war to get away from the British Navy, which he did not join voluntarily. He was pressed
wait, wait.
Into service.
Your great-great-great-great-grandfather was a draft dodger out of a foreign navy? So
no,
was mine.
No, he was not a draft dodger. He was pressed into service. I mean,
yes,
that was
pressed into service and then escaped.
Yeah, and he escaped.
Mine too.
All right. Keep moving.
But what you're talking about here is an immigration policy that is good for America and our economy and our workers in 2017. And what we had under Obama was this open door to the welfare rolls of the United States. And that's exactly what we got.
False. Nonsense. Not even remotely true. Look, the policy that was put out by last week from the podium basically rejected the values as presented in the Statue of Liberty. It did. I'm sorry.
No,
Stephen Miller said, but that poem, Give Us Your Tired, Your Poor, Your Hungry, Yearning to Breathe Free, that was added later, so it doesn't really count. No, it does count. It's the fabric of this country. And by the way, part of that fabric is encouraging the bringing whole families over and uniting families. It's one of the reasons that assimilation has been so effective, why we have the Great American Melting Pot.
I think the fabric that David wants to support is, you know, having people in the United States who have been deported 20 times, never effectively, and then they go out and they commit felony.
Let's make a transition because we're talking about two different things. As Steve, I don't want to be Stephen Miller to you guys, but there's a difference between legal and illegal, legal and illegal immigration. Let's talk about illegal immigration. Sanctuary cities, the Department of Justice comes down.
Rahm made a fool of himself yet again today, showed once again he cannot read in public, which is really pathetic. And even though I dislike the guy intensely,
I said nice things.
I'm happy to go over there, the fifth floor, and sort of get him through some elocution lessons, because it's embarrassing to have a mayor of the city of Chicago who cannot say the word Moldova without tripping over himself and then coming back and saying,
really?
Moldovia.
That's not your problem.
Go read that thing or go listen to it and see how bad he did. Now, on the substance, he's basically saying it's a Chicago value to break federal law and we're going to preserve it.
Not exactly what the mayor was saying.
Exactly.
You can go after Rahm for his elocution, but this is a city with a great history of inarticulate mayors. The police are here to preserve disorder, not cause disorder, or whatever Richard J. Daley said in 1968.
You know, tonight you're really living
in the past.
You got to get hip, man. It's 2017.
The point is, that's not Rahm's point. There's a legitimate issue here as to whether you're essentially trying to turn minority communities into basically turning their backs on the police. And it's the same issue that happened with illegal immigration on the Muslim ban. If you need the support of these communities if you are to have a safe city. And what Chris is proposing would not encourage that.
All right,
it's utterly absurd. David is going down the realm. He's going down the path of having no-go zones. That's where this ends up. If we don't have federal law applying in all counties, in every town, every hamlet, every state of this country, we don't have a lawful country. David is an attorney. He's sworn to uphold the law. He didn't take an oath to uphold the law only when convenient or when in the right neighborhood. What he's talking about is a total derogation of the rule of law, and that's what Rahm needs. Why? Because Democrats get votes from these communities.
Nonsense. You're pulling the whole 3 million illegal votes.
You guys are both going zero evidence. You guys are both going to the far reaches of the arguments here. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Tony wants to know, is Trump's main goal to eliminate anything Obama did as president? That's what we'll talk about coming up here after the break. Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right. All right, here we go. Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. We're talking about Touché. Trump 200 days here as we go through all the different areas. Let's talk international. How do you think Trump's been doing on the foreign policy?
I think you've got to give him some marks. David's going to give him an F-, but I'll tell you, I think he gets a B-, and I'll tell you why. Here's a great example. Just, 6 days ago, we have a unanimous Security Council resolution in the United Nations that is tightening the screws on one of the world's most rogue regimes, North Korea. And that is in large part because of leadership from President Trump and diplomacy by Nikki Haley. And the fact that, notwithstanding what the Democrats have said from the beginning of Trump's campaign, which has never been true, he's actually worked with our allies to get people thinking the same way, even communist China.
Well, is this just sort of rose-colored glasses? I mean, is there really that much of a difference between the way that presidents approach a foreign hostile like North Korea?
Well, number one, no. And number two, you know, it's funny. Chris is now saying, "Well, Trump got China to do this thing." I'm like, didn't Trump like a week and a half ago slam China in a tweet because of their failure to help with North Korea?
Maybe that's why they're
really,
helping now.
Really,
Dave?
Really, diplomacy by tweet?
Jeez, Dave.
Jeez. Chris,
take the scales off your eyes and watch a little bit.
My argument here is that Trump has abrogated leadership on the global stage. As Angela Merkel said, you no longer have a G20. You've got a G19. The United States is AWOL. And you can see that in the State Department with the absence of filling the positions, with Rex Tillerson's great disappearing act. He's been completely invisible. I'm like, where has Rex Tillerson? Oh, wait, I know where Rex Tillerson was. He was in the Philippines yucking it up with that murderous bastard Duterte, who's the head of the Philippines, who's killed. What do you mean it's ridiculous?
It's
He's
ridiculous.
Killed thousands and thousands and thousands of his people with no judicial process whatsoever, including
ridiculous.
A mayor today. Which part is ridiculous? It's 100% true.
Here is what's ridiculous. Your idea that somehow the Trump administration has been absent. I mean, Trump still already goes down in history. The first president to address the leaders of every Muslim country, 54 Muslim countries show up in Riyadh to listen to Donald Trump, to accept his view of things. And he was unvarnished in that talk. He said, we not only have to get it out of our societies, we've got to get it out of our places of worship.
Politico had a big article about
very
the
tough
East.
To say, compare that to Obama weaseling around the Cairo University talk in 2009. Trump is an active player. And when you quote Merkel, you're quoting a eurocrat who just wants more government, more, you know, sort of
otherwise
bureaucracy.
Known as the most important European leader. But
she's
of course,
the most important European
she's
leader.
Absolutely the most important European leader and has been for more than a decade. And only you, through your Trump-colored glasses, can somehow turn her into a, quote, eurocrat and diss this woman as if she's unimportant.
Well,
look,
the
fact is one of the key areas in for global leadership is in the area of climate change. And in the area of climate change...
Wrong. Climate change doesn't exist the way you think it does.
Oh, my God. You have got to be kidding
climate
me.
Change
you know, Chris,
has been
the funny
going
thing,
on,
the
Dave.
Article you pointed to in the New York Times that's coming out is going to say that a draft report prepared for the Trump administration has concluded that, in fact, the average temperature in the United States has risen rapidly and dramatically since 1980, and recent decades have been the warmest in the past 1,500 years. And the reason they leaked this report is because they were afraid that people like in the Trump administration are going to bury it.
Yeah, well,
this is
be,
critical. It's happening, and it's having real-world effects.
My gosh, your filibuster gear is really engaged tonight.
All right.
I'm amazed.
Let's talk.
Maybe you should
the
run
last
for the
part.
Senate.
The last part. Yeah, right. 2 minutes. We only have about 3 minutes left here. Let's talk about the media and
media.
Leaks. And this is
the media hates Trump, and the leaks come from the deep state, which hate Trump.
Deep state. There goes Chris again.
But Chris, don't all presidents for the last 50 years
nonsense.
Have to deal with leaks coming out of
yes,
the White House?
Everybody has to deal
so
with
leaks.
So is
it that special, or is yes, he making it
so was it the deep state against Obama?
Here is a very serious example from just the last 3 or 4 days. When you release the transcripts of the conversations between Trump and other heads of either state or government, I think it was heads of government, you're talking about unprecedented leaks, and I'm delighted that Attorney General Sessions announced on Friday that he is going. The Obama administration was tough on this, much tougher than any prior administration, and now Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration is going to be even tougher than the Obama.
But that being said, the idea that's being painted by the Trump administration is that they've had it so unfair compared to other presidents. And I'm saying, I think of Edward Snowden, I think of WikiLeaks, I think of the things that the Obama administration, and I'm no fan of that. The idea that, you know, finding out that our phones are being hacked, that's crazy.
Right.
But those are big leaks that the Obama administration wanted to deal with and did not want that to come out.
This is nothing new. I actually agree with Chris to a point about those transcripts. I think it's problematic when the leaders don't think they can have a private conversation with the President of the United States. That said, those transcripts revealed a couple of really interesting things. Number one, they revealed that all those stories that were written at the time that Trump and the White House said were all fake news. They were nonsense. It didn't happen. There was no tension in the call.
Right.
Of course, it all happened exactly as the media reported it at the time. And one of the things that the Trump has been going on and on about fake news is that every time he does that, it's about a report he doesn't like. And later, they turn out to be true. There have been so few that have turned out to be
not true.
There
is a stack of about 50 stories, very prominent stories that have been absolutely discredited. But the point David misses here, which is shocking because he is a licensed attorney in the state of Illinois.
Actually, I'm not. I'm a recovered lawyer.
You're a former. So okay. Once you were licensed. Maybe this is why you're no longer licensed.
Anyway,
I want to tell you, I who took 2 years of law school and left. But I want to tell you here, David is wrong not to point out the second basis upon which this is deeply troubling. He's right about heads of government or heads of state have to be able to talk to each other. The second point is this. The people who had possession of those transcripts are under a legal obligation not to release them. They broke the law. They committed a felony. And I hope they're thrown in jail for it.
And we don't know where those leaks came from.
We will shortly.
But this is one of the challenging things is that, you know, the, oftentimes the leaks are coming from within the White House itself.
Much more to talk about, and we will continue Monday night's Touche. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow at noon, the city of Chicago will celebrate the 50th anniversary of one of our most celebrated and controversial pieces of public art. We're talking about the Picasso at Daley Plaza. The sculpture was commissioned back in 1967, and if you were around, you know that it wasn't necessarily a slam dunk. Even politicians were concerned, some even wanting a more pedestrian statue of Ernie Banks or other sports figures. But we've come to love this amazing piece of art, and in studio tonight to talk about its lasting impact and, of course, the anniversary, Danny Shulman. He's the program director of cultural affairs at DCase. This year, they're celebrating the Year of Public Art. This is a big, the one-year thing, and this is the re-unveiling's part of that. Also in studio, Eric Coyne. He's the design director for Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the firm that Picasso made the sculpture for back in the 60s. Eric, Danny, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
So let's get right into this. Why a re-unveiling? I mean, because you could celebrate this, you could do a lot of different ways, but the idea of recreating or re-unveiling a statue, where'd this idea come from?
Right. Well, it's such a landmark. It was one of the first monumental, abstract works of art in a city, in a public place, at the scale it's at. And it's also a kind of beginning of 1967 is also a year of beginnings with community-based public art. The Wall of Respect is the other now lost object that we're celebrating this year. And that was a mural at 43rd and Langley that was a collaboration between a group of artists and a community. So in a way, it was on the other end of the public art spectrum.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, today you could put a big eyeball on State Street or something else, and people would be like, oh, it's public art. But in 1967, the unveiling of a 50-foot Picasso statue in Daley Plaza was something that Chicago had yet to deal with.
Right, absolutely. And it was, a kind of it came from a place of power. It came from Mayor Daley. It came from the leading architectural firm in Chicago and one of the leading ones in the nation. It was part of a reimagination of the central business district of the Loop. So it's very closely tied into the kind of rebirth of Chicago commercially.
And that's the reason why in the first place they wanted to have a statue down there.
Yeah,
or a sculpture.
Yeah.
All right, Eric, I want to bring you in. Skidmore, it's funny because it almost becomes a footnote to this story because you almost always think somehow Mayor Daley just, you know, had a relationship with Picasso and made it happen in a plaza that wasn't named after him yet. But for you, talk about the Skidmore and how Skidmore got involved in this in 1967.
Well, the story goes back to the creation of the building that the sculpture stands in front of, and that building was designed not by SOM alone, but an unusual team of architects working together on the building and the plaza. The three firms were Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, C.F. Murphy, and Lobel, Schlossman, Bennett, and Dart. And today it's hard to say, from our perspective, who did what, but the commonly acknowledged author of the building is a man named Jacques Brownson, who is credited with the design of the tower, which is awesome. It still is a very strong, very compelling piece of architecture today. But that group working together is said or alleged to have voted as a group on who should do the piece of art in the plaza. And they allegedly unanimously voted on Picasso, who at that time was super famous. I mean, he was a very accomplished artist, but he wasn't really a – it was a bit of an unusual choice because he was not at the peak of his fame at that time. He was kind of – had moved out of the public eye, and younger artists, you know, more edgy people were coming up like Richard Serra or Klyse Oldenburg at that time, both of whom have since done work in Chicago.
And I would say not necessarily his cup of tea to do sculptures for cities.
He had never done one before.
Right. I mean, we know him from his work, his art, but not necessarily for public sculptures.
This was the first time he had ever executed a very large-scale civic sculpture. He did several after, one in New York at NYU that's surrounded by three high-rise buildings designed by I.M. Pei, and another one in Oslo. At the time, he had also been invited by the city of Marseille to do a sculpture, which I don't know if it was ever executed. I think not. But he's reported to have said, when thinking about this, the city of Marseille is a gangster city in France, and they've asked me to do a sculpture. And the city of Chicago is a gangster city, and they've asked me to do this sculpture. You know, what gives with gangster cities and me? Why are they asking me
for
these
things? Why are they
attracted
to my work, right?
But in the end, he agreed to do it. I mean, he famously never signed a contract, and the entire process was just done verbally. And so in never legally agreeing to produce the sculpture, he was never bound by any deadline, which in hindsight was probably smart. It allowed him to have his creative process unfold however he wanted. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he did agree to do it, and he made two models with a local metal fabricator. And right up until the very last minute, he was still choosing between the two. And they both, to our eyes today, they look almost indistinguishable. But one was slightly heavier and one was slightly lighter. And at the very last minute, he picked the slightly lighter one. Mm. And that's the one that moved forward.
And Danny, I want to bring you back in just for the idea that, you know, that model that you mentioned, Eric, that model was brought to the attention of Chicago a year before. I mean, before this was actually displayed and put up as a 50-foot, this was given to politicians, to the mayor, and other places, and there was still some head-scratching. I mean, we're going to talk about that at, you know, this hour, but the idea that people are like, what is this? This is not what we want in our city downtown. This doesn't represent Chicago. There was a lot of consternation over the process in the modeling phase.
Right. Well, and that was also a kind of closely guarded secret. It was kept to very few eyes. And, you know, Eric can talk very well about the whole process of developing a 50-foot, how many tons? 60 tons, something like that, sculpture from a 3-foot high model or a 2.5-foot high model. And it's fascinating how the engineering took over.
So who had it? I mean, the history goes, but I mean, if it was such a tightly closed group or a highly kept secret, who had eyes on this? Was it just the politicians in Chicago?
No, I think very few politicians were able to see it at this point.
It was exhibited in September of 1966 at the Art Institute. It was originally, as we mentioned, built by this fabricator in France with Picasso together. They presented it to a man named Bill Hartman, who was a managing partner at SOM, and he was the kind of liaison between the team of architects and Picasso. And we can talk in more detail about what all that entailed. But in the end, he agreed to do the sculpture. He picked the light one. He gave it to Bill Hartman, who put it in a box and brought it back. And he brought that sculpture back and gave it to a man in the office, a young architect named Fred Lowe. And Fred Lowe's job was to take this handmade, very organic, rough model and convert it into orthographic drawings, plans, sections, and elevations, from which the final design could be structurally engineered, fabricated to be wind tunnel tested, and so forth. And so after all that process had begun, he brings the model back in May of 65, and a year and a few months later, it's exhibited at the Art Institute in public view. Now, I don't think probably a lot of people went to see it, but it wasn't like a blockbuster exhibit. It was a pretty small gallery.
Yeah.
It was the maquette, some photo montages of it in the plaza, and some drawings of it. That's it. really what that exhibit did, it put it in the public realm and frankly opened it up to attack by by all media. All the newspapers launched crusades, most of them against it.
But I loved about it, and I want to take a break here, but what I loved about that was the resolve of the mayor of Chicago at that time, because with the media and everyone and politicians around him, even people outside of the city saying, oh, this is no good, he essentially said, nope, we're doing it.
He dug in.
Well,
and he believed in the experts,
he
too.
Really did.
He had trust in Bill Hartman and, you know, get me the best and it'll be okay.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break. Danny Shulman, program director for DCASE, program director for cultural affairs at Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, is here, as well as Eric Coney. He is the design director at Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the firm that Picasso made the sculpture for back in the 60s. We're talking about the city of Chicago's re-unveiling, which is tomorrow at noon. It's called Everyone's Picasso, a restaging event of the 1967 unveiling at Daley Plaza. It's going to be musicians, all sorts of stuff happening downtown tomorrow for the re-unveiling of the Picasso. We're talking about it tonight here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests in studio tonight are talking about the re-unveiling of the 1967 unveiling of the Picasso in Daley Plaza. They're doing a restaging of that event tomorrow at noon right in Daley Plaza. In studio with me tonight, Danny Shulman. He's the program director for cultural affairs at DCASE. Also, Eric Coyne, who is a design director at Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the firm that Picasso made the sculpture for back in the 60s. Okay, so let's fast forward to the point where the mayor has the political will and clout. What an interesting concept, right? But the idea that says this is what we're doing with this space, because there was a lot of mostly in the form of the media. The media was saying we don't like this, that we don't know what this is. They were the ones that kind of championed the idea, and aldermen and other politicians picked up that mantle, saying, "Can't we do something else? Can't we do Ernie Banks? Can we do something that's a little bit more universal?" But the mayor stuck to his guns.
Well, and there were Picasso's politics, too, which were exploited. He was a well-known communist and an anti-fascist, so
that was easy to pile onto.
Yeah, but I loved Ron Grossman did the piece in the Tribune a couple days ago, which the great quote that mayor said, he said, he's an artist, leave the politics to us. Like, we got our own politics. We don't care what his politics are. And I thought that was very enlightening for a big city mayor. But the mayor did push this forward, saying, yeah, no, I'm not going to take this criticism. We're going to go with this.
He did believe in his team of experts. And he thought, if it's good for Chicago, if it will put Chicago on the map, then it's a good sculpture. And I'm not the one to judge what it looks like or what it represents. We'll leave that to somebody else to worry about. And he just charged forward with it. So kudos to him.
He had an interpretation of it that I thought was really fascinating. And I don't know if someone came up with this idea in his press office or it was his observation, but it goes to how multivalent and how many different ways you can interpret the piece. But his comment was, oh, it reminds me of the wings of justice. And I don't know if justice had wings or what, but you know, he made the best of it and came out with a strong statement.
That could have been an early use of strategery, perhaps, on the part of the
Possibly, that's right. One of the quotes as well that was in Ron's piece was, you know, what the mayor said that in the morning. He said, "We dedicate this celebrated work this morning with the belief that what is strange to us today will be familiar tomorrow." And that's a big part of the Picasso in Daley Plaza. The idea that, you know, you get used to public art and you're like, I don't know what that is. Is it a bird? Is it a what kind of skull? I don't know what it is. But after time, it becomes part of the fabric. It almost becomes the fun of it is to try to figure out what it is. Even into the 70s and the 80s, it becomes almost synonymous with Chicago in a way that no other piece of public art has.
But it's maintained its strangeness. It's still, I think, inscrutable and still strange, and that's its strength, I think. It doesn't, you know, it's not any one thing, and it defies categorization, and I think that some people hated it is a great thing. That's a victory. So it's that it has proponents and naysayers is part of what activates it, makes it interesting.
Eric, you guys at SOM before your time, but you guys were the ones who brought the statue or the sculpture to Chicago as part of the project there at Daley Plaza. You got backlash. I mean, there were letters sent to you. There were pros and cons and other things that were happening at SOM that the public has never seen.
Sure, there's for reasons I can't fully explain. SOM was in receipt of all letters and all correspondence generated about the sculpture, even ones that were sent to City Hall were then rerouted from City Hall back to us in a kind of classic not our right. not our problem move. So we have fascinating archives of these letters, both pro and con against the sculpture.
And you have a couple here.
We brought a few choice ones.
Would you mind reading snippets?
Sure. Let's read it. Let's read this one at the end here. This is to Bill Hartman. Dear Bill, congratulations on the culmination of your monumental effort. I'm sure the statue will become our counterpart of such attractions as the Eiffel Tower and the Great Pyramids. This is something that Chicago has been wanting for a long time, and now we have it. I envy you the good feelings you must have in bringing this about, and I'm glad that the architectural profession can share vicariously in the achievement. Mm. This is from a fellow architect. The ones that are more interesting are from
Chicagoans.
Regular Chicagoans. Here's one from an interesting one from the Sun-Times. Dear Mr. Hartman, I thought you might enjoy hearing of the very spontaneous tribute to the Picasso, which I happened to encounter recently on the plaza. One Saturday afternoon, a frail hillbilly-looking man in a long jacket that looked like a Mackinaw, but was not quite, shambled in front of the sculpture and stopped. "Now that's really something else," he mused in a tone of awe. "I'll bet the fellow that made the design on that carried off a bundle." I was nearby and commented, "No, in fact he didn't. He gave it to the city. His name is Picasso." "Well," rejoined our man in the street, art critic, undaunted, "I bet he gets plenty of work after this." I personally think that this was the best tribute to the Picasso I've ever heard. And while I'm at it, I might mention that since the piece is metal, white, I have been taking a series of color shots showing the rusting. I was extremely fortunate the first day because I arrived at the plaza just as it was beginning to drizzle, and in 30 to 45 minutes, I saw and recorded changes in rust as they occurred quite rapidly. The beast seemed to come to life in rust right in front of my eyes. It was very spooky. There I was in the enclosure with no one else around, with that great animal towering over me and coming to life. What will it do? What will I do?
Wow.
Don Schwartz.
Don.
Well done.
Yeah, well done. I mean, it's amazing that there's the archives of people who are for and against the Picasso. Rust was a big part of this. You kind of allude to it, but it was funny how that was the one thing that people take from it, because it did rust quick, and it did have this. It sort of changed the color of this thing. Talk about that. Talk about, was that the intent of this sculpture? Is it something, because you know we were at the early days of public art and display, that the architects and the custodians didn't understand what to do with this metal?
Yeah. Well, I think Eric should take this. I mean, it's all about – it was designed to do this. It was a new process, a new way of making steel.
Really?
And it was the same material that the building was made out of. So it formed this ensemble, an incredible ensemble.
So this is a unique at the time, very new and cutting-edge innovative steel technology called Core-10. And Core-10 steel at that time and in that building was very new and had probably never been used or had rarely been used on – very large-scale buildings, but went on to be used for many buildings and many sculptures. I mean, Richard Serra's entire career is built on using Core-10 steel. But the idea of this steel is that it rusts, and it rusts on purpose so that the rust forms a protective sacrificial layer on the outside of the structural steel, which is protected inside. And so when the sculpture we see today is that rich, dark kind of tobacco brown. But when it was new, when it was unveiled, it was bright orange. And you look at color photographs of it from that day, and it's shocking how different even
that's amazing.
The sculpture and the building, because the building was finished 18 months earlier. The building had probably already started to mellow.
Well, it's an architectural feat to have that kind of metal. But to the outside, to the Chicagoan, to the citizens walking by, like, this
rusty junk.
They just use bad metal.
Well, and that was that kind of captivated a lot of unexpected areas in Chicago, including burlesque. My colleague Tim Samuelson has noted that there was a stripper in Chicago on West Madison, I think, named Rusty Picasso. So it entered the popular realm. Yeah.
Oh, man. Tomorrow, a restaging of the Picasso. It's called Everyone's Picasso. It's a restaging event of the 1967 unveiling at Daily Plaza. There's going to be musicians. And are you guys going to tent it? Are you going to pull the tent off?
No, we're leaving it naked. We're leaving it. We're leaving it free and open. You know, I think we don't want to impose that much on it. I hope we're beyond the days of putting sports teams' hats on it and things like that. It doesn't make the Picasso estate happy, and I think it's disrespectful. So we're actually going to the unveiling is going to be an act of imagination and kind of symbolic. And we've commissioned an artist, Edra Soto, who's designed a kind of symbolic veil that will pass out so that people at a moment in the ceremony can actually veil themselves and imagine the plaza without the sculpture.
Wow.
And it's actually a gorgeous piece of art in itself.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a quick break for the news, and we'll come back. I want to ask about the lasting impact of this piece of art, and also as the year of public art, whether or not the Picasso is as Mike Royko kind of alluded to, and others have said that it's a fabric of Chicago. I mean, it's part of everything we're talking about. You can't imagine a Chicago without it, but can we? I mean, as the world moves on and more public art becomes every corner of Chicago. Can we live in a city without the Picasso? Well, Danny Shulman, Program Director for Cultural Affairs at DCASE, is in studio along with Eric Coyne. He's a design director at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, the firm that Picasso made the sculpture for back in the 60s. Like they said, everyone's Picasso. The restaging event of the 1967 unveiling at Daley Plaza, the 50th anniversary, is tomorrow at noon. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We will continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Danny Shulman. He's the Program Director for Cultural Affairs at DCASE. And Eric Coyne, he's a Design Director at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And we're talking about the Picasso. It's 50th anniversary. There will be a restaging event of the 1967 unveiling at Daley Plaza tomorrow at noon. It's called Everyone's Picasso. It's going to have musicians and art and veils. What a world would be like if the Picasso was never there. And it's such a, you know, it's so fun because we kind of alluded to the idea that people didn't really know what it was. And in a way, and I'm not sure if that was the intent of the artist or if that has just become the intent of Chicago, in the way that it's almost like field trips and kids and people sliding on the sculpture, but also continuing to guess what it is. To continuing to say, is it a bird? Is it, look at the head. You know, look at the color plays a part. I mean, was that the intention of Picasso in creating this art that was so abstract?
Well, Picasso's art isn't really all that abstract. It's never divorced from reality. It's very poetic. It's about metamorphosis, about change, about defying expectations. It's extremely playful. Picasso was interested in play. He was a playful, devious person. And his art was playful and devious. So, you know, that's part of why it's so enduring. It's a riddle that has a million different answers. So it doesn't really exhaust us.
Does it surprise you that so many Chicagoans have grasped onto the idea of trying to guess what it is or be a part of that experience?
Well, it alludes to so many things in such an interesting way. And it's hard to stop looking at Picasso. Because the questions just aren't answered. There are allusions to a woman's face, a dog's face, an animal's mane or hair or wings or, you know, one can go on. And that's what Picasso's art was about. It really implied everything and didn't exclude anything. And, you know, that sounds like a kind of superficial answer, but that's really... that's what Picasso was. And this goes back to the 19-teens. The things that Picasso was interested in then in sculpture, where he really revolutionized sculpture, this piece refers back to those to that period of the avant-garde in Europe.
You know, it also there was a lot of the pushback at the time, I mean, even the years after, subsequent years after, were about this is too erudite or this is too pretentious of a piece of art for Chicago. And it was Mike Royko who famously in the column said, no, you're missing the point. This Spanish sculptor, artist, it feels like he's rode the L in his entire life. The way that and a lot of what he was evoking was this idea of, like you said, I mean,
toughness,
the idea of change and things of that don't necessarily come from just the building of this material, but the feelings that are evoked from it.
Right.
So there was this connection, and at a certain point, when was it where the city kind of went away from the idea that we wanted? Couldn't we just have Ernie Banks and embrace the idea of Picasso?
I think maybe 10 minutes after the unveiling is when they went away from that, because now there it was. It was a fact on the ground, and it's probably not going to be changed. getting back to what you were saying about the different metaphors and the way that people interpret it, I think it could be said of all great works that they attract metaphor. And in their ability to attract metaphor is inherent an inability to say it's only one thing or the other. It must be multivalent and it must be many things. Mm-hmm. And that's why it continues to intrigue people in I would argue, the same level of depth that the Cloud Gate intrigues people. It attracts metaphor too, but it's a very different thing. It's still very charming. It captivates people. Everybody loves it. And I would say that today, maybe that has become the Picasso of the city today.
That's so interesting.
It's the focus of everyone's attention and everyone's excitement. And now the Picasso, like the Eiffel Tower or the Pompidou Center, has just kind of mellowed with time and become part of the fabric, and it's no longer this lightning rod of controversy that it once was.
You know, I mean, I asked the question kind of provocatively before we went to the news just about whether or not this will have lasting impact, meaning, you know, it's 50 years of Picasso and Daley Plaza, and every Chicagoan in generations knows it. But a younger generation coming up may replace the Picasso with Cloud Gate or other things that are happening, because this city has been on the forefront and been very progressive in bringing public art to the masses.
Right.
So what do you do with that? I mean, is there a point where, you know, it gets replaced, that the Picasso is not in the consciousness like it was 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, hell no, you don't replace it. I mean, it's unique, and it's unique in the world. But artists don't simply make objects anymore. You know, artists work in a vast number of ways, and they do that because Picasso showed the way. Picasso violated the rules, and artists today do. Anish Kapoor violates the rules in some ways, but other artists who we want to see working not just in the center of Chicago but in neighborhoods, you know, they do community gardens. They work like the Astor Gates, who develops communities. There are no limits on what artists can do in the public realm. And that's what I think we want to promote, the idea of the originality of this and how artists are valuable because they show us new ways of looking at the world and changing the world.
But it was in many ways the first domino that set in motion the long chain that wines are all around downtown, and now it goes out even into the city. And so it really, I don't think anybody had any idea of what the lasting impacts of it as a piece of modern public art would be, not only as a work of abstraction by a great European master, but as an urban space. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think just a block away, then later came the Federal Center a few years later with Calder in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And De Buffet, your question of what do we imagine? Do we imagine a plaza, a city without Picasso? Well, we may have to imagine one block to the northeast,
right.
The Illinois Center, without the De Buffet on that corner. If that building
gets sold
and torn down, what's going to happen to piece of art?
That is a tremendous point that, at a certain point, public art is protected because it's part of the public realm, and we know it and we love it. But there are times when the state, the municipalities, the other places, they may say, you know what, we're selling this building, we're making it a Shake Shack. Like, what do you do in that case? I mean, would we move a Picasso, or do you say, okay, let's put the tent over it and put it in storage and see what happens at a later date?
No, 50 years later, things do change. Yeah. And I think these works are vulnerable, and we'll see what happens. You know, I think it's definitely beginning to happen. Major public artworks that were privately funded that are in interiors have gone away. The Calder at the former Sears Tower.
Yeah, right.
That's a major loss, and there's not much
and that
city government
kind of
can do about that.
Overnight, and nobody has mm-hmm. said where it's going or who yeah. bought it or what's happened to it. It's just like Kaiser Soze, gone.
I will say it is – there's always been a push in Chicago, and you hear this from our politicians and the leaders who will say we want to be a world-class city. And when you think of public art, we're definitely there. When it comes to what we've done in our time, and this is the 50th anniversary, to think of public art before the Picasso at Daley Plaza is hard to do, especially in big cities. I mean, New York probably has some and other places, but this was sort of the beginning of really stretching our creativity when it comes to what public art can be. are we a world class? I mean, did that open the door for CloudGate? Did it open the door for others to say this is now not only what Chicago does, but we're going to prioritize it? Meaning that from here on out, we need to be at the cutting edge. We need to be the best when it comes to public art.
That's the message we want to send. And I think the unveiling ceremony, the restaging, is really going to be done by contemporary artists, by performers and poets and artists and youth who are engaged in art. So we really want to stress that innovation and the new and the future is what we want to be thinking about, just as we celebrate, a kind of pioneering object and public art piece.
Go ahead.
I mean, when you think about great cities of the world, you think about their urban spaces, you think about, probably you don't first think about their art, but when you think about them, they are in a way defined by the intangible combination of the city fabric. What is it like to be there? And art, while not the defining element of it, is certainly a critical aspect of it. And your question of what was public art before Picasso in Chicago, to me it was, how many monuments to Abraham Lincoln can we put in one city? I mean, somebody could just do a documentary of Lincoln monuments in this town. It's incredible.
Right. There's a ton.
But this finally broke that tide and opened it up to other things.
You know, as from a design standpoint, to have a piece like this, as big as it is in Chicago, to be relished and accepted by an entire city, even on bumpy beginnings. But what does that mean for architects, for designers, for others to have a piece of public art that is so roundly accepted as part of the fabric of the city that it lives?
Well, it's very common today, but back then I think it was a bit unusual to pair a piece of monumental public architecture with an equally important and compelling piece of public art. It's something that SOM has done. I mean, you referenced the Sears and Calder. Picasso, we worked with Miró on the sculpture that's just across the street next to the Brunswick building, also on Millennium Park with all the artists that are there. So it really is something that we try to do, and we try to bring it to cities all over the world that we work in still today. We recently finished a public library in Chinatown. And the public library in Chinatown has in it a beautiful mural by a local artist named C.J. Hungerman. And that piece really sets off the building and draws you up the stair to see this vibrant mural. It really is a strong companion in a very different way than the Picasso is, but it's still something that we're doing today, 50 years later.
And Danny, I'll ask you the same question from the Department of Cultural Affairs, Special Events, to have pieces of art, not just the Picasso and others, but to have pieces of art that are displayed in the public that are so so well loved at this point. What's it mean to you as a programmer, as somebody who wants this city to embrace the arts that has happened?
Well, I think well loved is one good thing, but another good thing is the usefulness of public art. And maybe public art should be ephemeral. Maybe it should go away and be replaced by something else. We want to try to promote that through, you know, how we're recommending changes to our Percent for Art ordinance. Right now, artworks that are commissioned have to have a physical presence, but not all artists work in that mode where something is left to worried over for years. Artists can work embedded in government. They can work embedded in communities. They can work on issues of sustainability in cities. They can work on issues of social justice in cities. They can work in a performative mode. So there's this kind of world of possibilities that our ordinance limits. And we want to try to expand the definition of art and, you know, follow artists who have followed in the footsteps of Picasso.
So what you're saying is there could be an Ernie Banks statue, finally.
I hope so. Well, there's no reason why you can't have Ernie Banks and Picasso.
That's right next to each other. The city of Chicago will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Picasso at Daley Plaza tomorrow with an event called Everyone's Picasso. It's a restaging event of the 1967 unveiling. It's at noon. There'll be artists, musicians, a whole program. I don't want to just one more time, Richard J. Daley said, and this was from Ron Grossman's piece in the Tribune, "We dedicate this celebrated work this morning with the belief that what is strange to us today will be familiar tomorrow. In studio tonight, Danny Shulman, Program Director for Cultural Affairs at DCASE, and also Eric Coigny, Design Director at Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the firm that Picasso made the sculpture for back in the 60s. Eric, Danny, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it. Good talking Picasso tonight. 630 says, I just need to say that I freaking love the Picasso statue. Anytime I get to the city, I walk past it if I can. Anytime I had visitors, I bring them that I bring to Chicago, I'll always make a point to go by and see it. That's great. You know, I mean, I think there's truth to it. I also think that, you know, we saw it. We did the project where they made the statues talk. Remember that? That was really Deanna Dunnigan and others were in. Really great project here where you go to any of the statues around Michigan Avenue, you can press a button, they'll talk. But I wonder how much, as society becomes more immersed in public art, that we become more sophisticated. And because we become more sophisticated, we expect more. I mean, it can't be this sort of, and I know abstract's not the right word when you talk about Picasso, but the idea you can't have this sculpture that people don't know much about, it doesn't do anything, it's there, and, oh, is it a dog? Is it a horse? What is it? Now it's, does it shoot fireworks? Does it talk back to me? You know, I mean, there's the bells and whistles that go along with the stuff that you see at, you can't climb on. I don't know if it was designed. That's the question I should ask those guys. Was it designed to be climbed on? You know, because in revisionist history, they'll say, yeah, but I'm not sure. Because, I mean, that seems like almost a shortcut. Like we hacked that Picasso statue so people can go and climb, the kids climb to the stop and slide down. It's great. That's an amazing statue, and what a great idea to re-unveil the statue tomorrow at Dealey Plaza at noon.
I liked how Danny said too that he hopes, you know, the time of putting a, you know, Bears football helmet on it and a Cubs hat. I hate when they do that stuff.
They do it. You know what they do it too is the Sioux dinosaur. You know, over the dinosaur at Field Museum on the outside.
Like, wears a jersey of some
sort?
Yeah,
they put the jersey on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and Cubs hats are going to be out playoff time, no doubt about it. But you're right. That's, I don't know what it is. There's something about it that you love the civic pride of cheering on your sports team, but you also get that vibe that's like, act like you've been there before.
Yeah.
Maybe they're doing that with New England Patriots helmets on the Lions statues at the Boston Art Institute. I don't know. Maybe they are.
Yeah, the Boston.
I don't know, right?
Yeah.
Like, maybe they're putting like pirate hats or colonial hats. Mm-hmm. That's what it is, right? Colonial hats in the Boston Harbor.
Yeah.
Just throwing tea. With all your tea.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it just makes it look podunk, kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a big city.
Right.
With, like, great art. You know, put a Cubs hat on that thing. I'm a Cubs fan. I love seeing, you know, Cubs paraphernalia anywhere. But
and the same with, you know, they do that when it's, I get the idea. I mean, it's these are pieces of public art that evoke civic pride. Sports also evoke civic pride. Why not marry them together with a fashioned helmet?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know. I buy that either, but. Yeah, I wonder. It'd be interesting to see. I think I might go down there tomorrow.
Yeah,
because I've got a 1 o'clock in the loop, so I feel like maybe that would be fun to go do right beforehand.
Check it out. Yeah, for sure.
And you know, see if they've set up the winter German festival.
Chris Kindle Market.
Chris Kindle Market. Yeah, they've been down there. I don't know if they have.
A little too soon, I think. Well, don't get me started on, you know, moving the Christmas tree from the Kindle Market and the Dealey Plaza into the Millennium.
You don't like that move.
Oh, no. Every year I write a letter to the mayor.
You are writing letters. And then they go, you know what they do? They go, this is a Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill issue. Yeah. And they pass it along.
Yeah.
They just go, hey, no, they got a letter about the tree. That goes to somebody else. It goes to the tree company.
So 50 years from now, when there's a radio segment on the unveiling of a Christmas tree.
50 years, they're like, if I can read from one really ornery. He really writes a lot of letters about a lot of different things, various issues. One's about ketchup on hot dogs.
Yeah, I don't care about violence or anything.
You don't care about the big ticket issues.
Yeah.
If there was going to be a time capsule yeah. that you would be burying underneath your front porch, it would all be about these gosh darn Christmas tree. They moved it from Daly Plaza to Millennium Park. That's what people were talking about back in 2017. Yeah, so anyway, coming up, we're going to talk, it's Industry Night. This is our segment we do every Monday where we sort of talk about the food and hospitality industry here in Chicago. We had a lot of great people on. Last week we did it on Wednesday. We had Paul Kahn and Donnie Medea. We've done so much with Barrio. Chef Tanabe was on not too long ago, but tonight I'm very interested in hotel service and hospitality, especially when you talk about some of the new hotels that are popping up like mad in Chicago, especially down here. The idea of, you know, staying at the brand hotel is a thing of the past. And anyone who travels knows that not just a Chicago thing, that's New York, L.A., wherever. But the idea here in Chicago, a lot of that happens down on Michigan Avenue, the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel being one of them, with the Cindy's Rooftop, with the restaurants that are in there. I mean, it really is sort of the new way of room and board. So we'll talk about what goes into maintaining service hospitality when you are approaching a younger demographic. I'm not saying that only young people stay there, but this is really sort of come stay. It's almost like the Virgin Hotel and company, which is like, come stay here before Lollapalooza. This is where you want to be. Do you have to change your philosophy if you're a company that is trying to attract a younger demographic? You know, what goes into that? It's funny because I remember this, that the Hotel W, when it first came to Chicago, right, had two. I have a number of, we can do a whole show on Hotel W experiences. But the one, I was doing a show at the Hotel W in town, and I remember we went through the kitchen to the stage where we had to load in, and there was a sign on the door that said, do you have the proper W attitude? It was on the kitchen side. So it's like when you're about to go into the space. So it was like, ask, do you have the proper W attitude? And we stole the sign. Yeah, we did. It's on somebody's wall. I think we put it on the Schadenfreude window. It's like if you walked in our office, it said, do you have the proper W attitude?
And you guys hit it like, you know, play like a champion today, the Notre Dame thing. In the locker room, you guys hit it every time you're going, exactly. You know, psych yourself out.
Exactly. That's what you do.
What is the proper W attitude?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? I'm trying to get that answer.
Aloof and disinterested. Here's your room.
That's exactly what it. That was why we took it, because we're like, what is the proper W attitude?
I have to dig a little deeper on that one.
That is a question for the ages. I just want to get in that training. There's so much unanswered there. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night tonight. This is our weekly segment we do every Monday night. Focuses on the food and hospitality industries here in the city of Chicago and the area. My guest tonight, well, he had a busy weekend. Patrick Hatton is the general manager of the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel, the newly renovated luxury hotel on Michigan Avenue, and a popular spot for Lollapalooza goers this weekend. Running a swanky Michigan Avenue hotel has a lot of challenges. No longer is hotel management just about clean sheets and reservations, although that's still part of it, I'm sure. Now customers expect a little bit more, especially when you're catering to a younger demographic. Tonight we talk hotels, hospitality, and the hustle and bustle of one of the hotspots in Chicago. Patrick Hatton from the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel in studio with me tonight. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Appreciate it.
So Lollapalooza, I took an Uber in. I hit Michigan Avenue to go to Lollapalooza. It was crazy town.
Yeah,
there was a lot going on. How was the hotel this weekend?
We had a great time. We had a great crowd. We had a couple different activations happening in the hotel to kind of draw some people in. We were proud to partner with Flood Magazine on Flood Fest. It's their second annual show. So brought in a really, really curated group of people to watch Sylvan Esso perform in our basketball court, which was a lot of fun. But it was just a good time.
How important is it to, I mean, when you, right there, I mean, right away, the idea, I can't think of every hotel in Chicago that's catering to Lollapalooza doing just that, taking over a basketball court or trying to partner with some people who are coming in. Where does that come from? Where's the idea of partnering and having your finger on the pulse come from when it comes to hotels?
It's important for us to make sure that we're partnering with someone who's going to bring a new guest to us, someone who's maybe hasn't seen the hotel before. I've been in Chicago for many years and have been going to Lollapalooza since 2008 and have seen some of the stuff that happens in hotels and those after parties and stuff. So we're very careful in our approach and we look for the right partner. I've got a great creative team, including our PR group, that help us find ideal partners that, again, are going to bring in a good audience. It's not going to bring in, you know, an audience that has maybe been to the festival all day.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, when, like I said, when I got to Michigan Avenue, I was like, there is a lot going on here that usually doesn't on Michigan Avenue. How do you deal with a rowdier crowd, a younger crowd, a crowd that's in to essentially do a bunch of day drinking and hanging out and then come back to the hotel? What's the secret to make sure you don't have incident after incident?
We position ourselves from a rate perspective in a space with other luxury hotels in town, which kind of prohibits some people's ability to stay with us. And we have a max occupancy per room of four people, so we're not getting loads of people staying in one room. And we just have good diligence in terms of the check-in process to make sure that we're being thorough with people and we're being open and we're allowing everybody in, because being inclusive is important to us in terms of who our demographic is. But it's making sure that you're just positioning yourself to get the right people in.
It's such an interesting concept, the idea of being inclusive, because you work a lot in the exclusive. The idea of this being a luxury hotel and a place that you want an exclusive opportunity or experience, how do you provide that for people when there's so much competition in town, especially in a big city like Chicago, to have an exclusive experience that's all its own?
It's an interesting question. And the club, the building, was a private membership club for the elite for its entire existence. So we very thoughtfully, when we reopened it, wanted it to be inclusive. We wanted to make sure that the doors are open for everyone and everyone felt welcome. And it's been interesting to watch, because very organically, the demographic that's coming to the hotel is the broadest I've ever worked in, for sure. It's from the kids in the game room to people looking for a great food experience in the Cherry Circle room, and everything in between. In Cindy's, we've got a lot of former members that come in, are really proud of the place. And so for us, we wanted to create experiences that touched people. We can't be everything for everybody. Our goal is to everybody who walks through that door that we help them feel like, we make them feel like they're being part of something special. Even the people who just come in for Shake Shack on the first floor, it's a great restaurant, it's a great vibe. People maybe get their foot in the door at Shake Shack and then explore, and we hope that they do that.
Okay, it is interesting, because how do you balance such a historic place? I mean, the Chicago Athletic Club, that's the historic down on Michigan Avenue, and the history of that would draw me in. Mm-hmm. But how do you balance history with the now, with the idea of the being more progressive and trying to bring in a younger demographic?
It actually wound up being a lot easier than I expected. It started with the design. The designer, Roman and Williams, didn't want you to feel like it was a museum. They wanted you to restore it beautifully, but make sure you kind of felt the stories in the walls and in the floors. And we took that and use the storytelling angle as our kind of way in. So we actually hired a professional storyteller when we opened to train our staff, because we wanted to give them the tools to be able to tell the history of the building and what happened inside the building. But then we also wanted them to have the tools to help write the new story of the Chicago Athletic Association. One of the first programming initiatives we put into place is we started a storytelling series. So it was open to the public, free to the public. It started on Sunday afternoons. And we'd bring in interesting people, and we do live interviews like you and I are doing right now. And we'd record them, and we put them out for a podcast. And we interviewed Amazon Explorers and an 80s punk band and a local indie artist and Harry Kupchak, who's the son of the guy who did all the miniature rooms in the Thorn, the Art Institute.
Yeah, right.
And that really kind of took off, and people enjoyed hearing the stories of these interesting people. And so now we now have expanded it where we'll do panel discussions. And the panel discussions are really geared towards kind of with a mentoring lens. We want to bring in interesting people that can help. You have five universities surrounding us, so it can help some of these students kind of find their way. So we did a couple months back a How to Break into the Festival Scene panel where we worked with Dynasty Podcast, and we brought in people from C3 Presents and from Riot Fest and from Pitchfork and had them live interview. And we had 250 students crammed in that room taking notes and just trying to learn from these people.
Not what I would automatically think of when I think of hotel management. Right.
Yeah,
I guess that's what I'm getting at, like the idea that the hotel, I mean, you've been in the business. I mean, when coming up with these ways to essentially not only serve the clientele, but to market the hotel, say this is a great place, mm-hmm. come see this panel discussion. Talk about how that is that in your comfort zone? I mean, as you push to this job and having to do things that are a little bit more towards a different demographic, is it comfortable?
Not always, and it shouldn't be. When it's uncomfortable is I think when we're making a difference. We wanted to, we brought on a creative team to help, and they push me. And they push me in terms of sometimes I have to say no. But a great example, the team came to me and says, you know what, we have the basketball court, Stag Court. We should do a roller skating night. I said, you guys are crazy. They said, no, we have a guy who's got a roller rink and another guy we've got that rents roller skates. I said, you guys are crazy. It's a terrible idea. So let us do it. I said, once. You can do it once. And they did it, and it blew my mind. The people coming in for this thing, we sold out five sessions. The people came in with smiles on their faces and just so excited to be there. We are creating memories for these people. It went so well. We've done a couple sessions that I actually am now the proud owner of 200 pairs of roller skates and my own roller rink. And never in my life did I think that as a hotelier I would be in the roller skating business.
Patrick Hatton's my guest. He's the general manager of Chicago Athletic Association Hotel. We're talking about the hotel industry and service, especially when going for a younger demographic here in Industry Night tonight on The Download. What makes a great hotel? You know, I mean, this is a segment we do on food and hospitality, and hotels are obviously big business, and there's a lot of competition for mm-hmm. the people who are coming to spend their tourism dollars. What makes a great Chicago hotel?
It's simple. It's three things. First and foremost, it's the people. It's hiring the right people. More importantly, retaining the right people. We've got a great track record. We're 2.5 years in. We've got a 40% retention rate, which at a hotel that's heavy in food and beverage is unheard of. We have over 50% of the original team members still with us, which is great. So that's the important part. We give them the tools to take care of customers. But today's customers, they're looking for something different. With technology, you know, the blending of personal time and work time, or it's all blended together now because you've got your cell phone. Mm-hmm. You can do your business on your cell phone. So people are looking for experiences, and they're looking for an experiential environment where they can get their work done, but they can still kind of check out what's going on in town. And we feel that we can provide a full Chicago experience without ever walking outside if you have to, which is great. And we don't want to encourage that necessarily because Chicago is a great city, and Chicago offers that to any travelers that come in town, whether it's a tourist or a business traveler. But being able to make it easy so they can do it without walking out of the building is a great benefit for us. And the other important thing besides that is training the staff, making sure that they're really engaged and taking care of our customer. We're in a historic building, so there's some challenges that come with that.
Like what? Like just
elevators are a big one. We've got a 1,500, 2,000 people coming through our front doors every day, and the elevator support's a little tight. So employees have to use guest elevators for transport. So engage with a customer. Talk to a customer. I was talking to a gentleman today from Austin who was in for the festival. He actually worked the festival. And he said, Pat, your staff is so great. Every time one of them got on the elevator, I got on the elevator, and your staff was, they talked to me. Like, I'm used to being in hotels where the staff doesn't talk to people on the elevator. So I thought that was a nice compliment this morning from Matt.
You know, I think about the story that was out last week about Chicago tying Orlando for convention industry. Tourism is up in Chicago. Do you sense that? Do you sense that more people are traveling to Chicago to be a destination? And if so, what does that mean for hotels?
It is true, for sure. It's the work that the Choose Chicago has been doing, the city's been doing to promote the city, is paying off. We've got a big influx of supply as well. So 2.5% up in tourism last year, 3.8% up in supply. So pretty soon that math's going to kind of cause a little bit of a slowdown. But we think that what Chicago's offering right now is being noticed. One of the areas that I see, and we happen to get a lot of international travelers with us, is international travel, which is generally lagged in Chicago compared to some of the other markets, is growing pretty well. It's doing really well for us specifically. And I think one of the things that will help us kind of take advantage of that trend, guests are looking for, travelers are looking for local experiences. And a lot of hotels, it's kind of an industry buzzword that we want to be authentic to the neighborhood and local. And you do that with amenities and with products and inclusion and partnerships. We do it in a different way because I feel strongly that in order to feel like a local or live like a local, you need to be surrounded by locals. So we have a tremendous effort through our programming department and through our partners, whether it's Johala Productions or Land and Sea Department, our restaurant partners, to bring in a local scene so that when you're sitting in the drawing room on the second floor of the CAA, it's 80% locals and 20% guests. And now I'm living the life of a local. And I think that that will give us an advantage with the tourism trends. And yeah, supply is going to keep going up because it's a hot market. It's a great market to be in.
Well, this town is one that is now no stranger to hotels. I mean, I think right where we're at right now, I mean, you got the Marriott, you got the Hyatt, you got the Sheraton, you got the Palmer House. I mean, there's a lot of different places that are not just hotels, but they're well known. They're they're almost tourist attractions in their own right. Mm-hmm. When you have to compete against tradition, and you have to compete against a marketing plan where people already know where the Palmer House is, how do you do that?
It was particularly hard in our case because we were never a hotel. It's still called the Chicago Athletic Association. And we left the name on purpose because Chicagoans are so proud of all things Chicago. If we were to change the name, oh my gosh, there would have been riots. But, it's just providing different experiences. It's providing simplicity for a traveler. We want to make it easy for them to get experiences. We've really gone all in on technology. There's some great new technology trends coming out for guest communication where we don't want to take away the face-to-face interaction with the customer. That's cherished, and we need to protect that. But being able to give today's traveler what they want now, we can do it. So we've got this new app. It's not an app. It's a website called ExploreCAA.com. And a guest can go on there, and they're prompted to go on it when they check into the internet. And they can order room service. They can make reservations at the restaurants. They can check out the special events that were happening. Who's the storytelling series this Sunday?
Yeah.
Have all of that in their hand. And so we're trying to make the guest experience simpler.
You know, just from your experience, I mean, in the last 10 years, hotels and the relationship with customers has changed. I think of the way that people book online, number one, where it used to be that, in our generation, there might have been a time you had to pick up a phone, maybe early time you had to do websites. But now, I mean, it is mobile. People can get instant feedback, reviews on your hotel. How do you navigate that? How do you stay above the fray when there's so much information that's being about your product that you don't have control over?
It's by being proactive and responding to the review sites. We want to be engaged with our customers, even if it's through a third party site. It's about, making sure that the customer knows that once they've come to stay with us, that dealing directly with us or coming to us directly, they're going to get the same thing they're going to get through their mobile devices. So our technology has to match the best technology that's out there, so that the user experience at our website, our mobile platform, is as good as anybody else's. And then once we get the customer in, then we get the opportunity to engage them and create a relationship with them where they feel now like, oh, I'm going to call my friend and book my hotel reservation, as opposed to I'm going to go to 1-800 whatever and book a room.
Right.
We want to kind of create that engagement relationship with the customer.
You've got Cindy's Rooftop. You've got mentioned the restaurants as well. You definitely have the product around the hotel, around the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel, is exclusive. In the way that people want to get up there, they want to stand in line to get up there. I mean, I've been close by where people want to partake in the establishments that are in the hotel. How do you make sure that your guests are feeling exclusive when there's exclusivity everywhere? Meaning I've run into this problem where I feel like I'm at an upscale hotel and I'm like, oh, that's a nice line. And you're like, that line's not for you. You can't, even though you paid the money to go here, you can't go into this hot rooftop. Mm-hmm. How do you blend that, the idea of making people feel special, but also be a place for outside people that aren't staying at the hotel?
It's a great question and something we were very thoughtful of when we opened the hotel, because a previous hotel company I worked with opened a great hotel in New York, great rooftop at 9 o'clock at night. Guests had to go downstairs, go outside, walk around, get in the line, wait for the snarky doorman to decide whether they're pretty enough to go up. And I thought that was terrible, and I hated to see that. So when we opened the hotel, we specifically wanted to protect the guest experience. So our guest key cards, if you're staying in the hotel, the guest key card works to get you up to Cindy's. We specifically don't get to capacity so that we can accommodate any guests that come up. Will you be able to get a table? Maybe not. Yeah. We're working on trying to improve that experience by engaging our customer in conversation as far out as we can. So starting 3-4 weeks before their arrival, we're reaching out and saying, hey, Cindy's brunch sells out about 6 weeks in advance. Can I help you with a reservation before you come in? So that we're giving guests that opportunity. Our most exclusive space in the building is the milk room, which is the former Prohibition room. And it's an 8-seat micro bar at night with 4 seating, so 32 people get to experience it a day. That sells out 6 weeks in advance.
Right.
So we specifically reserve 2 of the 8 seats for every seating to accommodate hotel guests or to accommodate someone who's come into the Cherry Circle room and is a regular of ours and says, hey, I want to take my friend to the milk room. And we've done that so we can accommodate. There's risk in that. Obviously, we're taking revenue that could be in our hand and we're setting it to the side to protect the space for our guests. But we wanted to make sure that the hotel guest experience was thought of when we created these kind of interesting spaces.
Last question. You've been in the business. What does Chicago's hotel industry and scene need to work on? What do you think? I mean, you mentioned New York and other places, but what is it? And I don't mean your place, but I just mean all the places in general that Chicago needs to up their game in.
To be honest, the market is relatively quick to drop rates and to lower rates in order to drive business. And we've trained the customer to know that they can wait. And they're going to be able to get a great deal on Lollapalooza weekend if they wait until Thursday. I think as a market, we could do a better job of being proud of what we have and pricing it appropriately for what the guest is experiencing. Beyond that, it's continuing to work with these conventions and bringing the conventions in and taking care of them, making them feel great. The ASCO and the RSNA conventions are two anchors. And we go out of our way to make sure that they know how much we love them and we want them here. We need to do that with more conventions. We need that with all of our conventions so that we can keep them coming back and grow our convention portfolio.
Patrick Hatton is the general manager of the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel. We're talking the hotel industry tonight here on Industry Night. Patrick, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. Coming up, Studio 435, Dream Version will be here. A trio is going to rock out tonight. Very excited to have them here. Rolling Stone magazine had their new album, Fight Fair, as a must play. And they are about to head out on tour, actually leaving tomorrow. So how great is that? They're going to be here first. So fun. Dream Version in studio tonight. I'm looking forward to it. So two things that I want to talk about. One was, this funny story about hotels. And I got to tell this right because I got to remember it. It was a couple years ago, 10, 12, maybe, probably like 15 years ago now. But they had opened a new hotel on the lakefront, right? It was like a luxury place. And we went there thinking, oh, this is going to be so fun. It was like an anniversary. It's like maybe a 2-year anniversary or something like that. We'll go here and we'll get a room and we'll just party in Chicago in this hotel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice, right? Real nice. A lot of purple.
Mm-hmm.
That's how nice it was.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we get there. You know, we check in. We get upstairs. Cool music. Cool view right on Lakeshore. It's so beautiful. And then we're like, we go down to eat. You know, I think there was a problem with the bill, but I don't remember what it was. I think it was just more me trying to channeling my dad. You said the potatoes were one of those. So I was just like, all right. So anyway, when we were done, I was like, let's go to this club, man. They got a club up here. They got like on the 12th floor, like doom, doom, doom.
Yeah,
doom,
you're a guest.
Doom, doom, doom. Yeah, and I'm looking good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had like a cool shirt on, cool.
Yeah, ready to go.
It might have been linen.
I hope so.
I remember back then I had a cool pair of linen pants.
Oh, so you went like a whole linen outfit?
I don't know. That might have been part of the problem. I don't think it was all linen, but it was partially linen.
Linen pants and then a regular, like a cotton jacket.
And a rayon shirt. Mm-hmm. It was a real doozy. No, I mean, I had the appropriate wear.
Okay, so yeah, you're ready
to
go.
Yeah, some sort of design t-shirt,
mm-hmm.
you know, like one would in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Like a Ed Hardy kind of thing.
Fantastic.
So we go over there, and I was just under the assumption that because we paid a lot of money for this hotel, that we would be let into the club. I even think that was part of the agreement. So we get there, and they're like, hold up. And they're like, this gets you in line, but it doesn't get you in the club. And I was like, what? So they essentially told us, they're like, you can't come in. And after we stood in line for a little bit, they're like, no, this is a hot night. It was Saturday. Maybe if this was a Tuesday, dude.
You'd get in?
Yeah. Like, there, give me that one.
It was because it was a capacity.
It was definitely like a up, down. No. This is not the clientele we're going for.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And this was a good looking Justin.
Yeah.
You know, now, I mean, you take it or leave it. I walk in and they're like, that guy, well, maybe he knows the owner. We'll let him in because he knows the owner. But and over time, I figured out that's all confidence anyway. But I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, you can't come in. This place is packed and your dockers and your rock ports don't work. You know, and I was like, all right. So we went back really kind of dejected.
Yeah,
it was
that hurts.
It was like 10:30. It wasn't even that late. And so we're just like, so the next morning we went downstairs and we talked to the concierge. You know, like, can I help you? And my wife and I dispute who said this. I feel like I would be the one who said it, so I'm going to say that I said it, mm-hmm. although I will get crap.
Stories differ, but yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But we started arguing, saying, listen, we came here, spent the money. You know, we wanted a good experience. We didn't want to feel rejected, you know, by a club. And they're like, well, and I go, and as the person tried to explain themselves, well, it's a very exclusive clientele, blah, blah, blah. I said, you know what? Don't BS a BSer, right? That's different language.
Mm-hmm.
You were a days in like a week ago. I guess I said to him, I go, we're not some guys who just pulled our U-Haul up from Omaha, Nebraska and rolled up here and not sure, oh, well, I guess we'll stay here.
Yeah.
Like, we know what's up. You were a days in that converted and changed the lighting. Nothing else changed. You put some cool EDM early acid jazz on and change the lighting. And you're charging me $150 extra for that. I get it. Now, come on. Yeah. Have some respect for people who live in this town who wanted to do a little staycation. So I kind of called them out. Some hand gestures, things like that. And they said, all right. They said, okay, you know what? Because of your stay, we'll give you another stay. So they gave me another one. So I'm like, all right. So I think it was we waited another couple months and we went back, right? And we're like, yes. This is where the story gets stupid. So I'm like all excited. I'm like, yeah, you can't stop me now. I got like a wristband that says you cannot discriminate against these khakis.
Yeah.
Right? And we go early. Because I still want to hedge the bets. I'm still not trusting.
Yeah, you don't
want to
go
right.
in there at midnight.
So
when
we roll
it's
up at like
bumping.
Saturday night at like 7:30.
Mm-hmm.
Something yeah. way too early where nobody's in there. And I'm like, yes, we're in. And I look around and every one of the little booths in this little club, I mean, it's a very little club. It's not even like a cool club. It's just very little. And everyone said reserved, right? They had reserved. People who had much more money and cooler pants had reserved space. So I said, so the woman comes over and she goes, I mean, it couldn't have been better on cue. She goes, guys, you can sit here for now, but if somebody else comes in, that reserve, there, you're going to have to move. You're going to have to leave. And I was just like, I can't believe that. Like, we got in, and yet
we're still getting rejected.
They're still trying to kick us out. So my strategy, Pete, this is the strategy that I used to try and beat the big hotel, They can't kick me out if I'm drinking.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I'm like, gin and tonic, right? I remember this. And that's why.
A gin and tonic? It wasn't a bottle of anything?
No, I was like, I just keep bringing the gin. And this is why I don't drink gin and tonics anymore. And so, like, I just got disproportionately drunk. Like, the kind of, like, not that I wasn't, like, out of control.
Yeah.
It's just, like, I drank probably too many gin and tonics in the 20 minutes I was there. I'm like, I'm guzzling. I'm going to keep the bill open. I'm going to show them. Right? Just really, really thinking ahead, right? And so we get back. So we get done. We're like, let's get out of here. Let's go down to the other bar or something like that. And we're like, let's stop at the hotel, right? So it's like 10 o'clock. We go back in the room. And I lost my marbles.
Mm-hmm.
And ruined the night, like in the way that, like, there's this great my wife will say she remembers it as we had like a cake because it was our anniversary or whatever we brought from home, and she was eating it with a fork without cutting it, and I was in the bathroom, you know, tossing it.
Yeah.
And that was the picture she saw, and she's like, she shrugged her shoulders and kept eating the cake. Like, it was like, well,
you got to let that play out.
Yeah, you got to let that
enjoy the cake.
Yeah. So, needless to say, my experience with the high-end hotels did not go well in that experience. And I thought it was funny that I came back, like, raring. I was ready to show them. And then I think I proved why they wouldn't let me in the club in the first place.
Yeah, like, I think so.
I think they were like, yeah.
We made the right decision.
We made the right decision. And you know what? I think they did, too. So, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll come back. And I want to talk about Lollapalooza. I went on Saturday. I brought my son. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that experience. That was Saturday night. It was an eye-opener for me since I haven't been to that festival in, 12 years now. Lots of shirtless dudes shouldering me. So
fun.
That sounds like a blast. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Studio 435, Dream Version, the rock trio, will be in studio performing live. They're about to go out on tour, but right before they do that, they are live with us tonight. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Patty Vasquez coming up at 11. So, yeah, I did it. I got a chance to go to Lollapalooza. I was able to take my son, as promised. You know, we're kind of going back and forth on whether or not that would be a good idea. And I had an opportunity to go to the festival that everybody's talking about as a 42-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an idea, I went up to the bar area and I said, I don't know how this works. Do you need to see an ID? And the woman goes, I'll take your word for it. I was like, that never happens at Taste of Chicago. Is that evident that with my beard, my gray whiskers, they're like, just put your hand out. We'll just put this band on. Oh, okay. $10, cool. So the entranceway, so I kind of mentioned to Patrick when we were talking about the hotel, I took a lift to Michigan Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I got off of Michigan Avenue, and I got to say, man, that was it had a real sleazy vibe.
Just the outskirts of the festival, outside of the festival grounds. Yeah,
it was a nice night, Saturday night, but there were a lot of shirtless guys trying to get you to buy tickets and bands and selling stuff and goofing around and staring at you too long. Like, it just really, it was surprising to me how much kind of riffraff was on Michigan Avenue. Now, I know there's nothing you can do about it, and the police were busy dealing with it.
There's too much to even do anything about.
And there was a police officer who I heard their radio go off, and they said, we got 15 jumpers over on Mission Monroe, like fence jumpers. So they were dealing with a lot of stuff. But it was just, I could see why. I mean, there was just a lot of peripheral. It reminded me of a Cubs game. Have you ever been to a Cubs game where you don't go in when the game starts? So when the game starts and you hang out, I was doing a shoot one time where we're not going to the game, but we were kind of messing with the fans before they go in, just having fun. And we then decided to go to Sports Corner or whatever to have dinner. And while the game was going on, we didn't have tickets to the game. And it's kind of like you pull the rug back and there's just a lot of riffraff hanging around that you don't necessarily see when there's a ton of people trying to go into the gates. Same thing with Lollapalooza. You're like, wow, so this is the people who don't have tickets. It's almost like they've created the cottage industry around Lollapalooza, you know, but it's a little sleazy.
Yeah. I'm sure scalpers are probably
scalpers.
Trying to, you know.
I'm sure it's no different than any sort of big sporting event. So where we entered at Balbo, and it was funny because I got great advice not only from this show, from Download Nation, but I got great advice from some people on Facebook that said, you're going to have a great time with your son who's 10 if you just avoid the EDM stage.
Perfect.
There's one stage in Lollapalooza that's just straight up DJ music.
Stay away from that,
and
you're good.
Yeah, that's just where people go to drug out,
mm-hmm.
as my 42-year-old dad. Drug out. So the way that the festival, where we came in to the festival, the entrance way, it's a little side entrance kind of thing, led out at the EDM stage.
Oh,
like,
no.
Like right in, you so pour right into it. I mean, it was funny. I was like, I was holding my son's hand pretty tight. So I'm like, stay with me. You know, have you seen I Am Legend? We got to get off this island.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was as I think whoever gave me that advice, thank you to the Texters and whatever, spot on, because that was a sloppy area. It was sloppy. There were a lot of teenagers who were underdressed, so much underbutt. I mean, just like, oh, all right. And then there was just no regard
for anybody else.
For anybody else. Yeah. So that's why I said I got shouldered like 15 times. Like, they physically would just run you over because they were just like listening to the beat, or they were drunk, or worse.
Yeah.
And they just didn't care. And you know, they weren't caring about my safety. And I'm glad I took it on because I had my 10-year-old with me. And I'm like, I don't want. And then he get run over. His first experience, he walks in some, you know, mollied up mm-hmm. teenager just mauls him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I sound awfully old right now, but that's how it was. It was just out of control. No one had any street sense.
It seems logistically that would be an area that you'd just kind of leave that area go and let it be by itself and not have anybody shift through there.
And I don't know how it worked out. But then, you know, walking through, when I went past the roller rink,
a lot of pictures.
And
of
it was just,
rink.
It was just plumes and plumes of smoke and kids on their phone trying to yell at somebody. There was a lot of like sitting down and yelling at somebody on a phone, mm-hmm. just that kind of stuff. I'm over by the tree. I told you about the tree. So anyway, I got past that and I got to the fountain. You know, it's a Buckingham Fountain, and that's where it's kind of like the main entrance area. Fine, totally fine. And I realized that was just the one area. If you get
that's
out
the only
to the
area.
You get up to the main area, you're getting crowds that are moving from one stage to the other. Kidsapalooza was great. That was a wonderful thing. And the only problem I had was that we ran into the problem of boredom. As I tried to explain to my son, I was like, this is part of a festival. You sit in the grass and you listen to the music and you kind of people watch.
And he was like, Dad, let's go back over where we came in. Where the action was going.
He had that vibe where he's just like, he got ADD and he's like, I want to go here. I want to go there. I'm going to. It's like, there's no, you don't need to go to the hemp store.
Yeah.
The pop up. We don't need to look at the art. Come on, get out of there. So we got a great spot up on the hill. Like, there's a couple of hills in that south area because we were going to see Chance, right? Chance the Rapper. And so we got a great spot on the hill and just kind of protected it for an hour. With everybody coming close, and I was spread out. It was like spread eagle.
Do you have
like
a blanket and stuff?
No, but I was just spread out, like, sitting, like just covering as much area as I possibly could. Now this is just how I lay. I think I was doing that bit, you know, like trying to protect the space. And Chance came on, and I've never seen so many people. I wasn't at the Cubs victory parade. I was on Michigan Avenue. But I've heard some people say it was very similar to that because the amount of crowd went all the way to the fountain.
So 14 million people then.
So 26 million people were there. And, there was a moment in the set where, I mean, that was a perfect scenario. I stood up on the hill. We stood up.
Yeah, it's great.
My son could see everything. It was great. And no one blocked, no big guy blocking.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I thought there was a moment where he told everyone to take their cell phones out and, you know, turn them on. Almost like lighters. It's one of the slow songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was amazing to watch 100,000 people or whatever, because everyone's got a phone. And I think that my son was very He really thought that was crazy. Yeah. I mean, I did too. I was like, I've never seen anything like that. And the set itself, I have to say, I kind of made a joke earlier in the show. My expectations were really high. We talked about it on the show. We thought there would be guests and bands and all the people he's ever worked with in Chicago. This was like the payday. And he came out and he did his set that he's doing on tour. And it was pretty sparse. And he even said at the top, I'm not having any guests. Vic Mensa came through at one point. But the point being that he just did his show. He didn't do a special show for Chicago. And again, I want to preface by saying Chance is great and his music was great. And it was awesome to be there in that experience to see this kid from Chicago who went to Jones High School just two blocks from Grant Park be able to command a stage with 100,000 people with their phones out, you know, all for him. But I don't know. My expectation was I thought I would be seeing, you know, the
special, a different, step it up a little bit, not do the same thing that he's doing in Milwaukee and Detroit.
Yeah, is exactly it. Except for like calling out Rahm once, there wasn't much difference. And to be fair to him, I didn't see the end of the set because I took that opportunity. There was this moment where I was like, there was a lull in the show and I saw opening to the exit because we're close by the exit. And I looked down at my son and he kind of had this pain like, I'm so tired, like at 9:30, 9:45. And I just was like, let's go.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a walk to get out of here. And we took off and we were able to get through. And it's hilarious because the way out again was right past the EDM stage. And now the EDM stage was 10 o'clock at night.
Oof.
And it was just sloppy, like boop, 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 boop. And just like everybody, there's just people on the sidewalk throwing up.
Oh my god!
People dancing by themselves.
What
you know?
Does your son realize what's going on, or does he just not really even? Does it register with him?
I'm not sure it registered with him.
He just
I don't think he. I think he was taking it all in. I think he had a lot of fun, like getting his hair done. He had like got his hair blue at Kids at Palooza and you know fake tattoo, but. I was everything that I thought would be an awesome experience. I'm like, look at that. He's like, meh. I'm like, all these phones. Meh. And so even the walk out, I was like, don't look at that. He wasn't looking. He didn't care. Like he didn't have that kind of, he didn't have that ability to like kind of pull away from it and be like, wow, this is amazing.
Did he say what his favorite part was?
His favorite part was the Kids of Palooza. And he liked that Chance played I'm the One, which is the top 40 hit that he's got. Which was the one part I was like, meh, I don't know. Maybe do some old stuff.
Yeah.
Do some more off of Surf and leave I'm the One to Oakland.
Yeah.
Or Milwaukee or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, but Miles loved it. He loved it. He went crazy for it. So.
When I hear there's going to be no guests tonight, part of you is like, oh, that's disappointing. But then you're like, is he tricking us?
Yeah. Well, he made a very poetic kind of experience where he was like, he said something to the effect of, you know, all the promoters were asking me about what I was going to do, and I wanted to make it just me in Chicago tonight. Yeah. I said, well, with me in my hometown. And I'm like, I don't mind if, I don't know. Lil Wayne was here too.
Yeah. He was busy. Let's pretend like it.
I don't want to be that guy, but I'm like, it's okay. You can be, Chicago likes guests. Not just you. I mean, it's Ollie. I mean, we'd love to. So it was a good experience. We got lucky. We got a cab. The best part about it, because I live in the city, is that I was home before that Chance was done.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting in my living room being like, that's it.
Turn on the news and they at 10 o'clock, they're like, what's going on at Lollapalooza? Yeah. Like, just left.
Just left. And that's the one thing I will say. My son is lucky that his parents are street smart and have been there because everything I did was on the experiences of these kind of shows before.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I knew where I needed to be. I knew where the exit was. I knew the hill was better. I knew how to maneuver. Yes, there was a little boredom in there in the sense you had to just sit there and listen to some music you didn't care about.
Yeah.
But we didn't put him in harm's way. Like, it was a perfect...
Yeah,
like, I knew where the cabs would be. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that you had to walk to Dearborn.
Yeah.
You know, and so we busted through to Dearborn before everybody else and... Boom, cab, in, gone, like the wind.
That sounds great. It sounds like an overall great experience.
Yeah, it was a good time. This is Chicago's very own 720, WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. I will say this. I'm now looking forward to the teenage years where there were some teenagers that were right next to I was listening to these four girls that were like right in front of us. And like, your mom's asking us where you're at. And, you know, she's like, well, tell her we're over by the hill. Tell her she's supposed to meet us by the pink and white tent. I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, that's come. Like, he's not going to want to be around you guys.
No, not at all. I was like, and the parents in this scenario, they just kept being like, come to us. And these girls were like, no, we are where we're at and we're not leaving. I was
like, when your son goes by himself next year in 2 years, when he doesn't want to be seen with you, he'll know to go to the cabs on Dearborn.
That's right. He'll know. So there you go. All right. Coming up, Dream Version in studio tonight. But first, the news, 10:01. Here's Rob Martyr. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly segment that features live performance in our All-State Showcase studio right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we bring you the Chicago band Dream Version. Dream Version is a rock trio that just put out the album Fight Fair, an album that singer-songwriter Alec Jensen called, quote, a failed protest album. maybe the message. We'll get into that, but certainly not the music. The album's layered. It's mature. It combines the right mix of melody and anger. Dream Version is Eric Brummett on guitar, keys, vocals as well. Alec Jensen, of course, of vocals, bass. Michael Kunick on drums, vocals as well. They leave on tour on Wednesday, but they are in studio tonight. Dream Version, what's up, guys? Thanks for being here.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Thanks for being here. All right, so let's get right into it. Failed protest album. I love it. I mean, I was sent a short essay about this album, and I love it. I mean, the idea of what gets in the way,
right,
of all of our desire to protest.
Yeah, so it's an angry album, and it started out as an attempt to write sort of an extroverted, like, let's kind of change the world kind of record. And then I found myself running into all these roadblocks where I would ask myself, well, what are you doing about this? And the answer was usually nothing. So about half the album is trying to figure out the answer to that question, why aren't you doing anything?
Would you call it a theme record in that regard? I mean, do you kind of look at it like this is all sort of going after that existential question? That
yeah, more so than anything that I've written before. I mean, there are a handful of songs that are taking people to task for things in a very straightforward way. But then again, about half of the record, it's like trying to figure out what's going on psychologically that's preventing me and I think a lot of other people from making changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let me bring the other guys in as well. I mean, when you guys are creating music, do you think of it message first, or do you think of it this is a great melody, this is a good song? Like, what? Talk about the process of taking Alec's words and some of the message that we just talked about to music.
Well, I mean, you know, so Alec is definitely a lead songwriter, so he'll come to us with songs, not so much words already, and then we'll hear the words starting to come in, the melodies come in. But I will tell you this with the message as far as playing together, and I don't know how it does affect us, the way we play and the way we sculpt his demos, but we do have conversations about, like, here's what we're doing. Here's what this is about.
This is what the song's about, right.
And, you know, we've talked about this before. I guess it is part of our process that does also have an outcome on the way we perform songs.
Yeah. Let me ask the same question, Eric. I mean, for you as a guitar player and someone who produces music, I mean, do you think message first, music first? What's your process?
Yeah, it's Alec is you know, he's a great songwriter, and he comes to us with oftentimes pretty fully formed ideas, and this album was I found it really easy to get behind this message and to just latch on to things, and there were several things that I think Alec wasn't even totally sure if, you know, how does this read, is this right for us, is this going to be a song on the album? And there were some points where we were like, yeah, absolutely, this has to be on the album. You know, there some moments he wasn't sure if they, you know, if it meant something to someone else other than him. And to me, there were moments there where I heard things that really hit me. And that's a cool thing to be a part of,
yeah,
even
right.
when I've had no role in writing something, you know, to have that, to be able to get behind what it's about, it really means a lot.
You know, for you, as someone who, when we said it's kind of like a theme record, when you're writing songs, you're demoing songs, you're getting the band together, you're playing the stuff, does it become harder to kill your babies in the way that, that maybe the third or fourth song, you're like, that's not, but that was, that's a big part of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, we cast a pretty wide net. For this record, I wrote probably a solid 20 songs. And so one way that these guys, it sounds critical, but one of the ways that these guys are really helpful is, so they're like, there are a couple songs where we're like, you know, this is a great song, but it's not a Dream Version song. And so that's actually helpful to me. And it's also really helpful to see what they'll latch onto. Like there's this one song, Shame, on the record that's like a, just like a 5 minute long drone. I mean, it's like something that I would assume would only connect with a very small number of people. But when they heard it, they were like, yeah, we got to do this. And I was like, really? I mean, I was psyched, but
right.
I was surprised. I was surprised.
Connected
with two.
Connected with two.
Do you guys, I mean, and I had the good fortune of being able to read the essay and be able to internalize what the message of the music is. If I'm just stumbling across your music, here's a good example. Before I was sent anything, and I do this, I'll be in the car. I know that you guys are coming up on the weekend. I'll put the album on. I'll start listening to the stuff, right? And I don't know the ethos. I don't know any of the philosophy or what message you're trying to get across. And frankly, I have to say that, you know, based on the way that iTunes and other places now give you the option, I can shuffle, I can move things around.
Right.
I'm not listening in any order that's going to necessarily key me into. Or, you know, like, so how do you deal with that as musicians, the fact that a lot of people will be listening to your music for the music, not necessarily for the message?
Yeah, it's tricky. If you're not a really well-established artist, I think it's hard to really get people to take an album seriously as like a unit, as something that needs to be listened to from start to finish. So, I mean, we have always taken pride in kind of thinking of our music as a little bit of a Trojan horse, just in that it should be able to hit people on a relatively immediate level and sound poppy and melodic, hopefully. And then the idea is, if you sit with it for a little bit longer, you should be able to, you know, it'll reward repeat lessons.
Right. How do you guys approach that? I mean, the idea that essentially making a de facto theme album in this day and age is a lot tougher because of the technology that people use, the platforms that people consume it on.
Yeah, I think if you go back to when we were trying to make a track list, that was a big thing. We, you know, there were certain sacrifices we had to make, thematic sacrifices we had to make to take into consideration how people listen, and that they're, you know, if you watch, you know, you can, nowadays you can track all your plays and stuff online, and you always see the first song on an album always has way more plays than any other song. You know,
our poor last songs.
I love our last song. I've loved our last song since, you know, the first time I heard it, and it's gone through this crazy evolution to be what it is on the album. There's actually something kind of satisfying about knowing that the people who get there are going to have, hopefully have this reward that
Does that put pressure on you guys? I mean, I think of a different time, and I'm thinking like now the idea that you can see how many people press play on an album, whether it be SoundCloud or the impressions on any of the streaming stuff. Does it change the way you approach an album, that you're like, our first song has to be great so that people will stay for the hook for the second, third, fourth, fifth?
I mean, the other weird thing that you can do is like a lot of independent bands use this site called Bandcamp, and you can set which song plays first,
right?
So we'll like switch it up, and you and you can see the songs that you make the most readily available to your audience are the ones that they'll listen to the most. So I don't even know necessarily how much it has to do with the quality of the song or how much it connects. It's just like,
whatever's
there
to
hit people over the head with, whatever you're making it the most convenient for people to hear.
That has to change the art form.
It does. Well, you know, like on our last record, what's considered, it was the single, and what's probably the most popular song, definitely the song, even at our shows today, it still connects most with people, was like number 9.
Yeah, I think it was Track 9.
And that was dumb, you know, as we look back. I mean, it fit there, and that's, and we make, well, we make
for it to be Track 1.
I know, I'm sorry. We thought it was too emo, but that's why he writes the songs. And on this one, we're like, oh, that's a good idea. Yes, let's use that song. But anyways, we learned from that, and frankly, because it is a song that really connects with people, and it took a long time. Now it's there, but it would have been there a lot sooner for everybody had we put it at number two or number
so
one.
So interesting.
That's always been the pressure, though. I mean, you listen to Purple Rain, you're going to hear most of the best tracks in the first three or four songs. You know, it's
And it is true. I was just thinking about how Apple Music does it. They put a little star next to the songs I'm supposed to listen to.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure you guys are the ones that say that's the song that we want. I don't know.
I was going to ask you guys about that, actually. I'm not kidding. I was on my to-do list this week.
Yeah, I don't know how it works, technically. But, I mean, it is that tells me this is the song that other people have played the most. So click on this one.
Oh, that's probably similar to, like, Spotify. They just whatever song's been played the most recently. They have Some of it's based on all-time plays, and some of it's what's popular now.
Yeah,
but, it's like a – it doesn't – necessarily get people to the best song or the song that they'll like the most or anything like that. It's just kind of what people are playing, which happens to usually be the first song.
Well, it's an interesting contrast as musicians, especially what you guys are, what you guys have accomplished with Fight Fair to go after a themed idea, this failed protest album in a day and age in which it's hard to tell a story through tracks.
Yeah.
Because of the way people listen to it. I just think that's an interesting contrast.
Yeah, it's hard because my inclination, my sort of knee-jerk reaction, I'm always against whatever new technologies just appeared. It's not a rational thing. It's not a good thing. So I try to think about David Bowie sometimes when I think about, okay, embracing, anticipating what's next. You got to understand this is the way that people are going to listen, and you can't go to war with it. There are ways that we should that we can be taking advantage of it. You know, we've never actually really done much with releasing just standalone singles, but there's no reason not to. I mean, that's how people are listening to stuff. So that might be the next thing that we try. We should just drop a song here and there.
Alec Jensen, Eric Brummett, Michael Kunick, they are Dream Version. They're going on tour on Wednesday. The album is called Fight Fair. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We will come back live music in Studio 435 with the band Dream Version. Stay with us. Welcome back to Studio 435 here on the Download, 720 WGN. This, of course, where we play the best live music Chicago has to offer right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue in our Allstate Showcase studio. Tonight, the Chicago band Dream Version. That's Eric Brummett, Alex Jensen, and Michael Kunick. The album is called Fight Fair, and they're about to leave on tour this week. But before they did that, they come in here. We appreciate that. So let's hear their first track tonight, the song I Can See Everything. Here they are, Dream Version. Take it away, guys.
Oh.
we go.
Thank you.
Love it. Dream Version in studio 435 tonight. That was Eric Brummett, Alec Jensen, and Michael Kunick. The album is called Fight Fair. That track was called I Can See Everything. They are heading out on tour this week, but they stop by here at Studio 435 before they do that. All right, here's what we're going to do. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll get another sound check. We'll get some songs for the second half of Studio 435, our weekly segment where we feature live music in Studio 435, our Allstate Showcase studio here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435, our weekly segment that features live music in our Allstate Showcase studio right here on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, the band Dream Version Trio, Eric Brummett, Alex Jensen, Michael Kunick. Their album, their latest, is called Fight Fair. The rock trio are leaving on Wednesday, but they're in studio tonight. The band Dream Version, here is the track, I'm Still As Spoiled As The Day I Was Born. Take it away, guys.
I borrowed a tie to burden my body. Drain me like a sink, make me weak and godly. Transform me from a little child. So references were checked and forms were filed, and my first mistake was doing hard work for its own sake. Now my frame is battered and worn, and I'm still spoiled as I was born. 15, I admire your silver hair. Sunken eyes and the troubled look you wear. Hard work for its own sake. Now my frame is battered and worn, and I'm still spoiled as the day I was born. And the moral is,
that sustain on that keyboard. I love it. The band Dream Version in studio tonight. Eric Brummett, Alec Jensen, and Michael Kunick, the trio. Their album is called Fight Fair. That song was called I'm Still As Spoiled as the day I was born. Put the microphones away here, or the instruments away. Get back on those microphones. All right. Let me ask about Alec. I wanted to bring us back to the conversation about the album and everything that goes into it, because you know, you in the essay that I was reading about putting this record together, you say my definition of fighting fair, it turns out, means not fighting at all.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So, you know, when I was writing these sort of fight songs, the question came up of, well, if I write this song, am I fighting fair? So that became either having too much empathy for the people that I'm angry with. The first song in the record's called I Want to Be Angry. And it's like, I want to be angry, but it's like this thing that I can't do. And at least one of the things was like talking about, there's a lyric about the pressure on the cops. And so I'm like trying to work up this anger to motivate myself to, you know, to go out and protest, you know, in the streets about police brutality and stuff like that. And then there's this part of me that's like, just, it's just a natural part of my personality that just goes to empathize, like, and to imagine, well, what are things like from the police standpoint? And then, you know, there is something that I think most people wouldn't hesitate to tell you is a good thing. It's a positive trait, but there's like a weird way that it gets in the way eventually of doing some good. And I guess the other thing is just, I was raised Protestant, and there are all kinds of Christian ideas also that, you know, the same kind of thing. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Well, okay, we're gonna sit around for a whole pretty long time before somebody takes the president to task for his latest charades or whatever. The question sort of became, all right, am I gonna shed these kind of personality traits that I've always thought are good? Are they actually good?
To be able to showcase this anger, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting because you mentioned in the essay as well that, you know, you kind of have the reason this all came about is you sensed an anger.
Oh,
you go
yeah.
to different shows and things like that, and different bands, and you guys essentially wanting to change your sound almost in a way of saying, you know what, let's get more aggressive. Let's not be a pop band. You know, you lost a member, and it was like, all right, let's do something. Let's key into the zeitgeist. Let's get in there. But you couldn't pull it off.
Yep.
Yeah, the last song is just like, never mind.
Yeah. That was another thing about sequencing. It's like, all right, are we going to end with like that first song that we performed in here? Right. I can see everything. It's like triumphant. Like, we're going to go out there. No, we ended the album with a shrug. Like, oh, I don't know, guys.
But there's something in that. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I do find that, you know, this is really an expression of art. And a lot of times art gets combined with political protest and other things in that regard. And I think it's incredibly honest to talk about how that's hard. It's hard sometimes to be able to, I mean, it's sometimes a mark of a good artist is to say, it's not as easy just to be angry, or it's not as easy to, it's these issues that we're talking about in our society are a little bit more complicated than just sort of like,
It's really important for us not to, it's just kind of part of the philosophy of the band, never to present ourselves as glamorous or heroic. It's just, we're only human.
If you follow our Instagram feed, you'll know that. And we're not even that funny, turns out. But we try. No,
are you talking about my typo?
Oh, no, no. Oh, okay. Oh, how about the one you posted of me looking like my dog just died?
Oh, yeah.
while performing live. You know, one thing I would say too, though, that I really like is, you know, this album is it's not a concept album, but there are themes throughout it that are pretty serious and heavy. But, you know, we also are, what I love about what Al does is these songs are still fun and our live shows are still fun. And, you know, just at our record release show at Lincoln Hall a month or so back, you know, I was blown away by how many people actually knew the lyrics, so they know what's going on, what's being talked about, and we're dancing like, you know, drunk people at, you know, Last Call at a wedding. And that's a really cool thing,
yeah,
that
right.
we can do that. We're not like Rage Against the Machine or something here. Like, we are... Although I think you can access this however it works for you.
I would love that Rage Against the Machine would take your ethos for they're like, it's killing the name of, I don't know. That's a little harder than that.
That's funny. Yeah.
They're going to be a different kind of band.
Right.
Well, I mean, where do you guys, do you ever examine, it's hard, I get so heady here, but the idea that people are knowing the lyrics and they come out to your show and they're singing along. Are you hitting them with that sort of moment of emotion? Are you hitting them with the cerebral part that, you know, the lyrics are catchy, but they're also got something to say? I mean, what do you want the takeaway to be from an album like Fight Fair?
Oh, man. I mean, I hope that people have some kind of emotional response to it, including anger. I mean, there are some, man, if I, there are some... Mm-hmm. Some real shameful lyrics on the record.
Nah.
No, but I mean,
you're lucky I didn't write the lyrics.
You know, it's. I think it should be fun. I think that the music should be fun. I think there should be something that hits you relatively immediately. I would love for people to dance. I think that people are often driven to dance, and you know what? If you want to spend the extra time with it and get the extra engagement with it, I think it'll reward you. But again, you know, we're hoping that there's something right there on the surface level that is just that's
that
just
people pick
that,
up
that's
on
fun
it.
And that's
yeah,
and that, you know, people might react in their own emotional ways, but there's not just one way of experiencing it.
You know, for you guys, you're about to go on a tour. Mm-hmm. Talk about that experience. I mean, you guys are a trio. It makes it probably a little easier to maneuver on a tour. But, I mean, this is another moment for you guys in the way that you pack up your lives for a couple of a week, two weeks or so and go to different towns. What's that like for you guys? I mean, explain that to us.
It's surprising. It works really well. I mean, people keep at the last time we were out on the road, people kept asking us, how are you getting along? Are you guys fighting yet? Are you guys, you know, and we're... just kept saying no. I mean, it works.
Should we?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I get along with these guys really well, so it's fun to hang out in the car with them for, you know, weeks on end. I mean,
lots of fart talk.
Yeah.
Different kinds of farts.
Yeah, the farthest thing from cerebral.
Yeah.
Just leave that for the stage. Yeah. Right?
And, you know, it's always, it's funny too, like when people, if they listen to our album before we come into a town, and they have an idea of maybe what we're like or whatever, you know, or what the music's going to be like, to hear what we play in the car leading up to, you know, pulling it. It could be anything. Who knows what it is, but it's not like us for sure. So
he's just talking about, what was it, Cher? Is that what you were on a kick?
Oh, we were...
the last time we were on the road.
Shamefully, but the driver wasn't allowed to look. But we were streaming some Cher videos, and I could turn back time.
That's a good track, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good song,
strong
great video.
Stuff. That's the one on the battleship.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that before.
Say no more. Say no more, guys. The band Dream Version in studio. The album's called Fight Fair. Dream Version is Eric Brummett, Alec Jensen, and Michael Kunick, and they are going to be leaving this week for... tour. Where are you guys going to be? Like on?
We're heading south down to Austin, Texas, and it's pathway down and back.
There you go.
So. The last
All right.
leg.
Here's what we'll do. We will take a quick break, and we'll get one more song from Dream Version tonight, Studio 435. Stay with us. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight, Studio 435. Dream Version, the trio, just put out the album Fight Fair. They are Eric Brummett, Alec Jensen, and Michael Kunick, and they are leaving on tour this week, heading down to Austin, Texas area, right through that area, right through the south. All right, so we're going to wrap up here. The final track tonight is the title track, Fight Fair. Here is the band Dream Version. Take it away, guys.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. First rule of fighting fair is sit yourself one,
without sin, cast the first stone. My army's ready, should be any day now. Oh, but first we gotta wash ourselves clean. Wash ourselves clean. Lumber sell me across. Wash yourselves clean. Wash yourselves clean. And do it over. Wash yourselves clean. Wash yourselves clean. And do it over. Oh, you know I gotta fight fair. Fight fair. Fight fair. Fight fair. Fight fair. Fight fair.
Chicago band Dream Version in studio 435 tonight. The trio, their album Fight Fair. That was the title track from Fight Fair. Dream Version is Eric Brummett, Alec Jensen, Michael Kunick, and they are leaving on tour, going south starting this week. Do you guys have, you don't have any shows in Chicago coming up, do you?
No, not until September.
Not until September. Yeah. All right, there you go. You can find out all their stuff online. They got a Bandcamp page and everything else. You guys, thanks so much for playing tonight and being a part of Studio 435. We appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
That's going to do it tonight. The download. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Tomorrow night on the program, Robbie Foulkes. Back in studio. Love when Robbie stops by. That guy's great. It's been a minute since we've had him in studio, so it'd be good to have him back. Is he bringing his guitar? Yes! Great as that. Also, Christina Markoff will be here. She is the woman, the CEO of Vosges Chocolate. How great is that? She'll be my guest at Download Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. And we'll play The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Might still have some of those Wizard World Comic-Con passes. That seems to get everybody riled up. We're getting kids of all ages calling in, telling us what's the worst, killing tortoises. It's good stuff.